Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Made for TV Mayhem Show. This one is very special. The day I'm uploading this for everyone to listen to will be February 6th, 2021, which marks the 40th anniversary of the original air date of This House Possessed, which, as many of you know, is my favorite made for TV movie. And so to celebrate, I got the gang together. So Dan, Nate, and myself will be talking about the film for about 45 minutes or an hour. But before you hear that part, you get to hear me talk to Parker Stevenson about making This House Possessed. I was so excited that he agreed to come on and let me make an idiot out of myself in front of him. And he answered all my questions very nicely. And he gave some great background about the film, as well as about some of his other interests like photography. And so I really hope you guys enjoyed listening. But I'm just leaving this little intro here for you just so you have some context. And so you know that it's going to be an interview with Parker Stevenson first, and then a discussion about the film afterwards. So I hope you enjoy it, and thank you for listening.
Aren't TV movies fun? Join Amanda, Dan, and Nate as they discuss their favorite made-for-TV movies on the Made-for-TV Mayhem Show.
I'm not sure how much you're going to remember about making This House Possessed, and I don't know if I should give you some context for why I'm doing this, but it's turning 40 on February 6th in terms of the original air date.
Yeah.
10 years ago, I actually did a 30-year anniversary for it when I had a blog, and a bunch of people sent in why I love This House Possessed. It was a big film for us in 1981, and it had a big impression on us, and it was also a gateway for a lot of us into the world of horror. And you were a draw for so many of us as well because of the Hardy Boys. And it's my favorite made-for-TV movie. I think it's doing a lot with what I think looks kind of superficial, but is actually kind of a moving film about, you know, I don't know how well you remember the story, but about this girl whose memory doesn't exist from her childhood, and the house sort of loved her so much. You didn't want to be without her. And it was about letting go, right? And it had all kinds of stuff in it that I see as I get older. I met you years ago, and I had you sign my copy of This House Possessed script when it was under the original title, American Gothic.
Yeah.
And we talked briefly about it. And so I just wanted to do something special this year because it is the 40th anniversary. So I was hoping that you could give me, I'm going to ask you some questions, some of which I don't think you can answer. Some are really boring because I know nothing about the film. There's the only documentation on it is an interview you did to promote the film, right? And that's wow. Basically it that I can find, aside from some stuff about the house. And so I'm hoping that you can give us some context or at least some stories, because I know a lot of people would love to hear about the making of the film and your memories of it, and a lot of things about the movie that maybe you can help fill in some gaps.
When you asked me to do this one, I had to think, okay, so, because it was a while ago.
Yeah.
Oh, I have some really strong memories about certain moments and certain people, and Lisa Auerbacher I've known forever and still know. But it's really interesting to just be asked to kind of revisit something that was a long time ago and that sort of gets lost for me, you know, in daily life, dealing with whatever's going on in your life, with your relationships, your kids, your family. You know, these projects tend to get just kind of swept into the whole career. So it's kind of nice, actually, to be
good
asked to kind of reconsider some of this stuff.
Well, so you're telling me you don't think about This House Possessed every day, because that's really upsetting to me.
Oh, <my God. laughs>
Well, we know. So when you did the, you were at the Steel City Con in Pittsburgh when I asked you a question when you were talking, and everyone was asking about the Hardy Boys, which is the show that was my introduction to you and made me actually want to become a detective. And then I became a historian and a researcher. So I think that's what led me to it. But I asked you about This House Possessed, and you, the one thing you talked about was singing You Play Me Like a Song was your big memory from the film. And you didn't even really remember that you sang a song called Sensitive You're Not. And we're going to talk about that song. So, because that's the song that everybody remembers. But before we dive into that, I just want to ask you some basic questions. I'm not sure you can answer this portion of it, but since there's so little documentation on the film itself, do you have any idea what the budget of the film was?
As I remember, it was about $1.5 million.
Wow, not bad.
It was, I had a deal with ABC to do two movies for ABC after the Hardy Boys. And I submitted some stuff to them and they kept rejecting all the things that I liked, which just happens. And then they came to me towards the end of that deal, because it was a 2-year deal, and said, well, we have this movie we'd like you to do. And we'll pay you, you know, that deal that we made if you do this movie. And that's kind of how it came about. So I was sort of technically associated with the production, but I wasn't really. I mean, it really was an in-house ABC movie that they sort of threw me into.
Yeah, I read that it was part of your two movie deal was part of you would do one for them, and then you had to think a company called Parker Productions. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Did your company ever end up producing anything?
Avalon Adventures of the Abyss was done in association with it. And I did that. When was that? That was probably in the 98, 99. That was for Paramount.
Oh, cool.
And just a lot of development stuff, you know, buying scripts and pitching scripts and selling scripts. And
This is going to go veer off my script already. But so, I mean, in the 90s, you became a pretty prominent television director working on Melrose Place, right, and Baywatch, and shows that you had appeared on, like Melrose Place and Baywatch. In 1981, when you started Parker Productions, were you looking more at moving behind the scenes already at that point?
I wasn't interested in directing really ever, but I was interested in certain stories I wanted to do, certain movies I wanted to do. There was one, for instance, I gave to CBS that was called The Iron Orchard. It was a book. You know, I'm always looking for books. And it was about the oil industry. It was about Texas. It was about, you know, big, fast money. And I sent to them and I got a rejection letter saying, no one wants to see, you know, the oil industry in Texas. And about 2 months later, they picked up Dallas and Dallas became. I've had a lot of those, you know, that's usually when I've learned that when you have an idea that something might be a nice story to do and people might enjoy it, lots of other people are probably having a similar reaction just because of what's happening culturally, that something might be a good idea. So I've had that kind of thing happen a lot. And sometimes it works in your favor and sometimes it works against you, you know?
Yeah, it was pretty ambitious because I think you were about 28 when you made This House Possessed. So you were already kind of thinking big at that point, which is pretty interesting. So do you remember how long the shoot was by any chance?
Probably 4 or 5 weeks.
It's interesting. I don't know how many, I have to go back in my filmography in your head. I've been concentrating on this film so much, but a lot of TV movies, like say in the 70s, which was just right before you made this, were shot like in 2-3 weeks. So like, I think a 5-week shoot is kind of luxurious.
It was a new special effects kind of stuff that they were doing in the movie. That was
Yeah. New. It's a heavily effects friendly film. And even watching it now, like some of the, well, it's really a brutal TV movie. Like it's surprisingly violent for the era and for the medium. And I don't know how much you remember some of the death scenes, but like, of course, there's the famous blood shower with Shelley Smith, who doesn't die. She somehow gets ejected from the house. Like she spit literally from the house at that point. But like Joan Bennett's death of where she's burned alive in the pool. And also Kay Callan gets crushed in the car. And those are, the Kay Callan scene in particular is really brutal. And so I could see them taking more time for the special effects. So I have to ask, so you say you were getting scripts in this interview and you were kind of turning them down left and right and looking for a project right for you. Do you have any memories of what it was about This House Possessed that attracted you to the screenplay?
What about this one?
Yeah.
Things come along and you turn down a lot of stuff. You think, oh, I know how I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that kind of movie. And then suddenly something comes along and you go, well, that's not what I was thinking of doing, but it's kind of fun, even though I had to sing in it, which was not something I was looking forward to doing. That's when you learn you're either a singer or not singer when you actually do it publicly, and then you kind of go, huh, maybe that's not a good path for me.
I think you're really good in it. I wrote a book about TV movies, and I remember writing about your singing in it. I just reread the review to remind myself. I wrote, he's not so bad at it. And it was kind of a funny thing for me. Because I'm used to thinking of Sean Cassidy, I thought of you guys together for so long that because of the Hardy Boys as being the singer of the two of you. And so when you did those performances, I thought maybe you were a singer as well. But this was really your first time doing it, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'd sung like in high school. I'd sung, in college for briefly, I sang, in one of the college men's groups, but that's more hanging with your friends and doing road trips. And when you put yourself out and you do it, you sing like I did. And those weren't easy songs because they weren't really in my range. And that last one, I think the third one, which was You Play Me Like a Song, the lyrics were all P's. Play me like a song. You play. And P's are like the worst. You don't want to have to sing P's because they pop and it's hard to minimize it. Just all that stuff, I just didn't have the skills for it. So when that was over, I really realized comfortably that, singing really wasn't my thing. It has to do like Joseph and the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, musical plays. And I knew from then on always to say no.
Well, do you remember about recording those? Did you work with Billy Goldenberg or Carol Connors at all?
I worked with Carol. Carol was in the recording studio, and I think they were her lyrics. Yes. He did the music, and it was her lyrics. And she was really fun, but it was definitely outside my wheelhouse. But I got through it. It was fine, and no one made too much fun of me at the time when I did it. So.
No, they're really fun. Sensitive You're Not is like the song that all the fans of the movie remember because the lyrics are so crazy.
Collapse at the end up.
It's just such a great performance because you're kind of like a yacht rock singer. It's like this very sort of soft poppy music, and it's a weird setup because you're surrounded by all of your fans. There's no band. And you're very charming in it, but it's such a great kind of like moment where like you make some jokes and everybody laughs and you're like, Sensitive, You're Not. And you just break into it.
Yeah, I did have fun doing it. I had fun doing all the crazy, all the horror stuff. I've only done a couple of horror movies, really. But yeah, it was fun. I mean, anything you do something that's new and sort of something you haven't done before, it's kind of fun, But I knew I was walking a tightrope to be singing it all.
Well, you did a great job. And when you made the movie and they cast Lisa Eilbacher as your love interest, did it just happen that they hired her, or were they aware of your relationship on the Hardy Boys?
And it was no, I think they knew, and she was so right for it, because she has a sweetness about her, and she can play that kind of surprised innocence when someone gets crushed in the front gate.
Your character like runs up to the car, and then you're like, I can't do anything, and then you just kind of go back, and she's like, what?
Don't go back in the house. I guess what people maybe respond to. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that it still has a life, but it does because people come up to me and ask me about it and talk about it. I think it's because it's out there and it's just fun and campy and yet played straight. We played it straight faced and weren't winking at the audience. We just sort of did the story and let the story, which was pretty outrageous, kind of.
Yeah, I think it worked, especially in that era of the TV movie, because I lecture about TV movies, and one of the things I talk about is how TV movies were really permissible. Like adults wouldn't often not take you to go see Friday the 13th, but they would let you watch a TV movie because they just knew it was going to be more restrained, right? And so it was a gateway film for a lot of people to watch. And some of the memories I have of the articles that people submitted to me was my friend John said that he had to be in bed at a certain time, but he would sneak out of bed and try to see what his parents were watching, like from the stairwell or whatever. Yeah. And they were watching This House Possessed, and the blood shower scene happened. And he was like 10. And he was like, I'm not really sure. I've never seen anything like this before. And it haunted him for years, And so he would tell people, have you seen the movie with the blood shower scene? So I think when I think back to the era of TV movie, and I don't know how many you were watching, horror was sort of on the decline, because in the 70s it was huge with the ABC Movie of the Week. They really churned out a lot of genre films. And so you came out in an era that there was a handful of really great films. This one, Dark Knight of the Scarecrow, Fantasies, which David Lindsay also made, and a few others, but it was really slim pickings in comparison. And and so I think it had a really deep impression on so many of us. But I know in the interview you also talked about one of the things that attracted you to the idea of making the movie was that you really liked the house, and that you have a degree in architecture even, and so you sort of probably understood the house in a way that a lot of people working on the film didn't. Can you tell me a little bit about your impression of that house?
I just remember when we first went to location, and it's a monolith. I mean, that entryway, all that concrete is just amazing. I didn't know that area down by San Diego, that was my first time down there. But it seemed like the right imposing and yet contemporary house. It wasn't, you know, an old mansion sitting on the hill. It wasn't like the Psycho house. It was something contemporary. And so all the electronic stuff that was, you know, that was dialed in on her and all that kind of made sense. You know, and you mentioned Slim. Slim was hysterical. He was so funny. Years later, I got to go to the Kentucky Derby with him. Oh. He took me as his guest to the Kentucky Derby, and the way people responded to him there, he was, you know, he was like the king of the whole Derby. with Joan Bennett and Slim, and it just was Shelley Smith. I mean, it really was a nice cast. They did a good job putting it together.
It's a great cast. Those were a couple of my other questions. Let me skip ahead a little. Joan Bennett made a movie called Suspiria that I don't know if you've ever seen, by Dario Argento. And in some ways, it's a similar film in a tenuous way. And she was considered, you know, by the time you were working with, there was one of her last projects. She was the grand dame of like TV and film. And I'm just curious what she was like in person.
You know, one of my regrets is that I didn't make an effort to sit and talk with her whenever we had downtime. I did that with some other people. I did it with Ray Milland, and I did it with Joseph Cotten, and I did it with, you know, other people that I've gotten to work with, to just try to get a perspective on what I was in, what I was involved in, and where this might go, you know, and how you deal with all of the ups and downs of being an actor. And I didn't get a chance to really talk to her, and I regret that. She really came in and was kind of very methody. I mean, she was, when she was on the set, she was the bag lady, and she had that big red lipstick, and she kind of bumbled around, and she was separate in a lot of ways, you know. And I think I was too young to really realize that it was up to me to make the effort. You know, she was coming in as a guest person, which is always hard to come in, you know, in a smaller part and kind of find your way through the production. And I was too young to really understand that I needed to step up and actually engage her. And I wish I had, because her career, you know, I later realized how amazing her career was. She was, you know, like Hedy Lamarr or some of the greats. And I really should have taken advantage of that. Those exchanges sometimes with people you work with are really probably one of the greatest kind of rewards of working. To kind of get to connect with people that you never would get a chance to talk to, pick their brains.
Well, Slim Pickens and you guys have great chemistry too on this movie. And you kind of already answered it, but do you remember any stories about like on set with him? Do you have any anecdotes?
With who?
With Slim Pickens.
Just kind of being mesmerized by his accent. I mean, he walks, steps into the scene, and he opens his mouth, and you're just mesmerized by him. Kind of swaggers in. He's his own thing, you know. It's just so great. And again, you know, he came in and he was the manager, and he kind of livened everything up because he's got that energy, you know, keeping the show going. But it wasn't until years later. I mean, probably it would have been at least a decade later that I was at the Kentucky Derby, where I really spent all day. I mean, he picked me up and he drove me out there. It was a couple hour drive out to the Derby track, and we spent all day there. And then I really got to know him. I was kind of finding my way in a lot of ways then. You know, I'd done the Hardy Boys and I'd done some films before that. And so I was kind of discovering, well, where does this go and how do I do this? And what's work like outside of the routine and kind of the protection of a set on a series where every week's the same, you know, you're kind of cranking out another episode. Yeah. So to go on location, start doing other stuff was newer to me.
You're very self-assured in the film. It's interesting because this isn't really The House Possessed related, but I recently interviewed Ken Achety for Shades of Love, which you did the Rose Cafe for, and he loves you. He just said the nicest things about you. And I think at that time, you were being seen mostly as a romantic lead. And Shooting Stars for me was a real eye-opener, and Stroker Ace in particular, as your kind of depth of comedy timing is so good. And I don't know that people really saw that. And This House Possessed to me, maybe I'm answering your question, but like, it's definitely a leading man role. Like, you're swoony as hell in this movie. Like, it's ridiculous. But at the same time, it's a horror movie, right? And it's not your story. It's Sheila's. It's Lisa Eilbacher's, right?
Yeah.
And I wonder if that was part of the draw for you too. Or were you already doing those kind of romantic leading man roles by 1981?
I had done a movie with Pamela Sue Martin.
That's right.
Which was sort of really my second film. And that was a young romantic lead. I mean, because of sort of what my background was and where I came from, I tended to be the all-American guy, you know, which was fine. That was a real working genre to play, you know, so I was grateful for that. Even in the Hardy Boys, you know, we were cute and we were young and you know, running around. So that kind of was still leading man. And that's pretty consistently how I get cast, how I've always gotten cast. And every now and then I get to do something a little goofier. You mentioned Shooting Stars with Billy Dee Williams. And that was, for me, was great because Billy was an icon and I was his foil. So the banter with him, I was sure that was going to go to series.
Yeah.
Aaron Spelling. And we had a lot of fun doing it. The Rays were good, but it, for some reason, didn't get picked up. And okay. But even that, you know, I'm playing a stuntman, you know, turn private detective with him, and it's sort of silly, but it's also kind of leading man type. It's rare that I get to, you know, I really play someone awful, and even when I'm playing someone awful, I'm playing someone you don't know is awful.
Right. Yeah, I'm thinking of one right now, but I don't want to be too spoilery about it. But do you have, so is there a kind of role that you haven't played that you'd like to?
I'd like to do a project, whether it's a series or a movie, something that really relates more to where I am now in my life. You know, I played 18 for 20 years, and I played 20 for 30. And at some point, you're just kind of repeating what you know those beats are and what those ideas are. And what I've discovered now that I'm almost 70 is that there are a lot of things that come in life that no one tells you is coming. I think people don't think of it, or they don't admit that they're having back problems, or they don't want to admit that they've got some medical issues, or that they're not able to do some things that they used to do, or how quickly maybe you need glasses, you know?
Yeah.
What are the things that come that people don't warn you about? And there are a lot of them. And all of that has to do with our mortality and how we have to kind of reassess, okay, how much time do we have left? Do we really, you know, it's not open-ended here. A lot of friends from college and school and stuff who are gone. And that every time that happens, it's a shock to me. So a story that really relates more to what I've discovered myself, you know, raising a family and that family becoming its own family and where that leaves, you know, me older in relation to all that is really intriguing to me. And it is short, this little journey we all get to be on. It's a miracle and it's short. So I'd like to maybe tap into those issues.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you on that. One of the things I also lecture on is ageism in cinema and how we sort of target things into the youth culture and we get kind of forgotten about in our stories. And like, this is where I go on another tangent briefly, but like Jackie Brown, you know, Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown is about an older couple. You know, Robert Forster was 56, Pam Grier was 44, which isn't that old, but by Hollywood standards, she's past her sell date for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that was a heist film, but it was also a love story between two older people who were both down on their luck, you know, and you never see that. And that's one of the reasons why that film has always lived so close to my heart, because as I get older, I recognize myself and the characters more and more. And there isn't a lot of films like that, you know, for an older audience. There's some. And then I think a lot of them, though, are sort of, they're great for what they're doing and they can be really empowering. But things like Space Cowboys, where it's like, we, you know, these journeys we go on that are more over the top. But I think there's something to be said about telling these small, real stories that we live day to day. You know, and I would love to see you play something like that because I think the audience is there for you. It's just finding the person that's willing to pay to get the movie made is the problem, I think.
Yeah, always. Yeah, always. The development routine is arduous and often really slow. It's sort of how my it's a tangent. It's how my photography really became serious to me, is I look to that to be able to be responsible for all stages of it, so that it's really more a reflection really of what my aesthetics are and what my interests are. Because often in development, that you get lots of chefs in there. I mean, I've developed so many shows where you go in and you have a very kind of an intimate personal story and a specific environment that is moving and telling, and the reaction usually is, well, can't they be a detective? I mean, can't they carry a gun? And we have all this opportunity to have drama if they carry a gun. And it's been like, okay, but this is a story about a single mom on an island in New England. Do we really need to give her a gun? Or are you interested in what that life would be? It's like chronic. It's chronic. And you realize, okay, well, that's just that this isn't the material for them. They don't get it. You know, it's you're always hunting the person that goes, oh, I was moved by this. We have to figure out how to get this made because it's important and it's touching, and I'd love to see this, but this is not an easy sell. Let's go figure it out. That's what you're always hunting for.
Well, hopefully you will find something like that.
Yeah, or not, or I'll just keep shooting my pictures.
Well, that's good too. So, again, another we're going off topic here, but which came first, the photography or your directing?
Oh, I've been shooting since I was shooting weddings when I was 14.
Oh, really? What is it about photography?
I like the serendipity of it, that if you are conscious of enjoying shooting pictures, and it's great with phones now, you just use your phone. But to what you discover in life, if you have a camera available to you, are moments that are glorious. And sometimes it's just an aesthetic composition or color palette, or and often it's a connection with a person. There's a moment. It's why I like doing portraits, because that's a journey with someone where you together kind of craft what this is going to be and discover what happens that's unexpected. That's the part that I really, the unexpected part. And it's not an accident. People say, oh, well, you got lucky with that shot. No. I walked around for 30 years with this camera looking. It wasn't an accident. I was ready to get that shot when I saw it. And when I say I mean anybody, you know, if you're
Right.
in that way. So I've always shot, and I crates of film, spools of film that some I developed myself and some that are just, you know, in crates. And I never really had any interest in directing because it's a lot of decision making, and I don't really like making decisions. I'd much rather stall and think about it until it sort of solves itself, whatever the problem is. And only because Hasselhoff, really, on Baywatch, is the one that kind of said, come back and direct. And I was like, no, and he said, come on, do it. And he got me to direct. And that was, it's great. It turned out to be something I was really comfortable, because I'm looking through the lens. I'm still looking through a lens.
Right.
Taking the world by lowering the camera and moving it to the left, it suddenly is right. That little shift suddenly makes it right. And I'm always looking for what's right, you know.
Yeah, I only discovered your photography later. I think actually I feel like it was fairly recent and maybe after we met last time, because I probably went on your website or something like that. And it's really beautiful photography. And I'm curious, when you were making, I think it's called Shadow of a Stranger. Of course, now I'm drawing a blank with Emma Sams and Michael Easton. I don't know if you ever talked to him about photography, but he's a really good photographer as well.
Who was that?
Michael Easton?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. Is he?
I
Yeah.
don't know if it's a newer thing, but his website also, he also does poetry. He does a lot of, a little bit of everything. I'm semi-obsessed with him, but just because he's on a soap and I love him. But he does a bunch of different things and they're all really interesting. But his photography is kind of it's really intriguing to me. And I was just curious if you knew that he did that and you talked about it with him.
I think I've seen him since we worked together.
He does graphic novels as well.
Oh, wow, good for him.
Yeah, you guys are so artistic. Both of you, you know, you're finding different avenues for your creativity, which is great, and pleases me so much. And I wonder if, as a photographer, looking for these, especially with portraiture, do you think that that feeds into your acting at all? Like, are you thinking about what you are searching for in somebody else and then trying to relay it to your character? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like the human condition or whatever?
I never thought of that. But, you know, for decades when I worked, I just played, you know, whatever I thought that character was. You say the words and you kind of find it and you play the situation out. And then, you know, as I worked more, I got more interested in, okay, but how is this different from me? You know, and how can I connect with someone whose values or thoughts or feelings are different than me and still have it be real? How can I make that real? Especially if you're playing someone who's a slasher, who's butchering people. And I'm not particularly method. I don't have to live it. I don't have to be it, but you have to really connect with it in a way that you can be comfortable finding comfort in that place. And that's probably does have something to do with the photography, which is where someone sits in front of you to be photographed. And that's a big leap of faith. I mean, they're trusting you're not going to make them look silly, that you're going to find help show who they are to me, in a beautiful way. I mean, it was a fellow that I shot years back who was a search and rescue guy, you know, who dropped out of helicopters down to get people off mountainsides that had been car crashes. And he was a rough looking guy, a lot of life in his face, you know, and he had retired from there and he was interested in acting. So he asked me to do a headshot for him. And it was such an interesting session because he was beautiful, but he wasn't, you know, wasn't Cary Grant, you know, it wasn't Michael Easton. He wasn't some, you know, beautiful face, but he was beautiful because there was so much humanity in him. So to trust that is an amazing experience if someone will go there with you, you know? And I think that is part of what, you know, when you're directing or you're acting and you have to trust the director that they're not going to give you direction that's just wrong. I think the most challenging thing for me these days as an actor, and I don't act a lot. When I do it because I'm excited about the potential of it. But sometimes there's such a low level of experience. People come from all different places to do these indie movies, and they don't have a lot of experience. And they're trying stuff. They're experimenting. And it's important for them to execute their vision, but they don't necessarily have experience doing that. And the direction can be confusing. Either too much direction, in which case you don't know what they're trying to communicate, or they have an idea that doesn't reflect what's actually happening organically with that cast on that set in that moment. There's so many levels to it, and only by sensitivity to all those aspects can something magical really happen. So it can be frustrating if you feel the potential and you know what's right here, and someone's like, just say it quicker and faster. We got to move on. We got another shot to do. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Well, that leads me to two questions. I'm probably going to forget the second one, but let me start with the first one. Let's talk a little bit about the director of This House Possessed, because there's very little information about him. I know nothing about him except that he and David Levinson made three TV movies together. They made This House Possessed first. Then the year after, they did a movie called Fantasies with Suzanne Plachette, which was a huge hit for them. And then they did a movie a couple years later called Kicks with Shelley Hack and Anthony Geary. And they had this little, I call it a trifecta of these films, but they didn't do anything else together as far as I know, but they're three fascinating films. And William Wired, he's a really interesting figure to me, yet I know nothing about him. So can you just talk a little bit about what you thought about working with him, or if you knew anything about him as a person?
What I knew when I heard he was directing is I knew he had done Tom Horn, the Stephen King movie, which I was fascinated by, that had come out. It was late in McQueen's career, but maybe right at the end. And he was playing, you know, he was playing a kind of a bounty hunter cowboy, and it was dark and it was really interesting. And I was thrilled that I was going to get to work with him, because, you know, there are a couple of people that were key to me whose work I really was fascinated by, not whose work I'm like, but just who I really connected with. And that was McQueen and Paul Newman. Redford on a lot of stuff, especially Redford's directing. But those guys in that time frame were the top, you know. And he had done Tom Horn, which sometimes watch it. It's just really interesting.
Oh, definitely.
So it just gave me comfort that he knew what he was doing, you know, and he did. I mean, he pulled off, this movie's kind of all over the place, and it's funny and it's sweet and it's touching. And yet people, as you say, are being, you know, these grisly deaths every time you turn around. Probably the commercial break, someone else is getting mauled.
So was there a lot of it shot in the interior of the house, or I know a lot of it couldn't be because of the effects, but were you able to spend a lot of time in the house?
Yeah, we were in the house a lot. A lot. And they were pretty good about it. It was, you know, it was new construction. I think they were worried about a film company coming in because they're mainly, you know, clamping lights on beams and putting tape down on everything. Everything's getting taped up and the tape leaves marks. And, you know, so I remember there was a little back and forth between the owners and the production just about what they were doing in there. But yeah, we shot in the house a lot.
You say the security system was already there. Were those, that all those monitors and everything were already set up? Is that right?
I don't think the monitors were there. I think
okay.
that like the monitor room, you know, when we go in, it goes dark when we walk in. That, I think that was the studio.
Okay.
Yeah, and they were running around planting cameras all over the house to make it look like the house is on wire that way.
Do you remember how they shot the end scene with the fire? Because it looks pretty authentic that they're burning down this person's house.
I remember it was hot.
I would imagine.
I remember that it was hot. The flames. I don't remember quite how they did it, although, you know, they bring in all these pipes with holes in it, just like in your fireplace, you know, you turn the gas on and light it to make it look like you got a real fire. Those pipes were everywhere.
Oh, so they were at the house.
Yeah.
Wow.
As I remember, they did it, you know, they lay it in front of the house and with the long lens, it makes the flames look like they're on top of the house. There's actually a gap between them.
And so something else you were talking about when we were talking about like looking at the character and how can you play this person that's not you. Do you remember what you thought of the character of Gary and what you wanted to bring to the character? Was there anything interesting about him to you?
Well, I remember just trying to sort out, okay, so if I'm going to play a singer, I mean, who is the prototype for that? I mean, is it Sean? Is it Andy Gibb? Is it the Bee Gees? Is it? And for me, even though it's really not what the character was, but for me, it was kind of James Taylor. It was sort of the reluctant singer, the songwriter more, the singer-songwriter who's a little more reluctant about what he does, but knows that he's got to perform and get out there if music is going to be heard. So that was sort of the choice.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Just in all honesty, you know, it was really more. I really was focused more on surviving the singing part. I saw someone sing right after that. Maybe it was Aretha Franklin or something. Right, it was up at the Universal Amphitheater, and as soon as she opened her mouth, it was like, oh, that's right. This is what singing is. It's not being in a booth with someone sort of saying, okay, maybe if you whisper it, it won't sound like you're straining your voice so much.
Well, when you're singing the Play Me Like a Song tune, because you mentioned Shelley Smith, she's so great in this film because that is a really fun, campy, over-the-top character. And I don't know how well you remember that performance in that scene, but like she's popping pills and drinking wine.
Yeah, I went back and watched the...
Oh, okay.
Well, but I didn't get all the way through it because my DVD player jammed, so I only got two-thirds of the way through it. But I was reminded that she was... Being high, popping pills, and I'm singing away as if, yeah, that's what she does.
What do you remember about working with her? Because she only really made films for one decade, but in my mind, because she did so much stuff, she's been in film, she was in film and television forever for me. But I know she quit acting in 91, so, and she really was a fairly new actress by the time she got to This House Possessed. I think she started a couple years earlier. What do you remember about her?
Do you remember why she retired?
I know that she, I don't know why she retired. She said she was I read an interview with her from the early 90s where she said she was sort of at a crossroads with her life. By the time 1989 rolled around, which is when I think she had that horrible pregnancy where her baby died. And then she got into surrogate parenting and family therapy afterwards because of the tragedy that she had trying to conceive a child. And, you know, when I think of Shelley Smith, I think of this really glamorous, gorgeous, kind of over the top person. And so when I read that interview, I was kind of taken aback by it. But I think that might be why she retired. I think she was at the end of finding an interest in that kind of work. It wasn't fulfilling for her at that point. But you caught her early on, and I'm just curious what she was like.
Well, I remember seeing her around because, you know, the in the network world then, it was really three networks. And so that world was fairly closed, and the events that were sort of ongoing, you know, it would be some affiliates dinner or it'd be a promotional dinner or, and it was the same kind of cast of characters that you'd see. And I would see her around. So I knew her just sort of from, you know, from those events, you know, it was, oh, hi, you know, nice to see you. And but I thought she did a nice job in it, actually. I really did. Right. I thought she kind of put herself out a little bit and did a nice job. And I admire that if that was what her path was and she made a different choice. I really admire that. I had a period maybe 10 years ago, 12 years ago, where I just decided, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm just kind of bored. I'm bored with the business side of it. I'm bored with the frustrations of it. And I told my kids, you know, that I was retiring as an actor. I wasn't going to act anymore. And they were like, oh, okay. And then after about a year, I realized, who am I kidding? This is what I do. This is what I do. And I can do my photography and I can write and I can do whatever I want to do, but I'll always act. And if something comes along I'm interested in, I will act and I'll do it until I fall over. That's just, you know, I just realized, oh no, you don't just retire. I think you don't necessarily just retire unless you really find that it's disruptive to the rest of your life. And acting is not for me because I you know, I had my time with my kids, raising my kids, and that was glorious. And my photography is glorious. And I mean, now I'm, you know, my wife is a chef, and actually COVID has been this challenging but kind of fascinating period. I've been shooting, we've shot 1,000 videos since COVID started of her food. She's a top chef. And so she's making all this food and I'm shooting it and we're posting it up, and that's its own journey. And if another movie came along, I'd be like, great. I did a little movie right before COVID time, which was called Last Call in the Doghouse. And it was sort of a cameo playing a writer. And I just really liked the part. I really connected with just who that character was. And so I'll always probably stumble my way back in, you know.
Well, I'm glad because I always love seeing you and stuff. And that kind of makes me want to ask a little bit about Lisa Eilbacher. Two questions. I saw Bradford May was a camera operator on the film. Yes. Did they meet on This House Possessed?
I think they did. And I wasn't aware that they were seeing each other or dating or anything during it. We were just working away. But shortly thereafter, I realized that they were together as a couple. And he was, he's terrific. And he became really a great cinematographer, you know.
He's worked on some of my favorite. I think he became a director as well. He directed in the 90s some really good TV movies. He did one with Andy Griffith and John Ritter called Gramps, where you know, Andy Griffith is like a murderous grandfather trying to get back into the graces of his family run by John Ritter. And it's one of the most iconic movies of the 90s I can think of, it made for TV, in terms of like people still talk about it to this day. And he did some really interesting things in it to play up Andrew Griffith's character and sort of juxtapose it against Sheriff Andy from Mayberry. Mm-hmm. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? He kind of really, it's very self-aware in a way. And and it's also just a really good movie. Those are two great actors. But he's a really interesting guy. And I saw him in the credits this last time I watched This House Possessed. And I thought, oh, I don't remember ever noticing that. So I was just curious if that's where they met. And also, do you know, you were talking about like how you always want to come back to acting, but she's pretty much dropped out of the scene. Do you know what she does now?
Lisa?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I see her occasionally at like an autograph convention or something. It'll be a press thing. And I'll see her and she looks the same. I mean, she looks great. She looks just like she did in the movie. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure she's still with Brad and they've been together all this time. And, I think she's probably just living her life and, but I don't know details of what she's doing. I just know when I see her, I'm always glad to see her. It's always sweet.
Yeah. She's just missed. I've always loved her. Again, cause I think the Hardy Boys attachment, but seeing you guys together in This House Possessed is always such a treat for me because it reminds me of more than just the film itself, but how much as a kid I loved Hardy Boys was very big in my life. David Levinson, also, like I said, he wrote This House Possessed. He was also a producer on it. Was he on set ever? Do you remember working with him?
I think he probably was on set, although I don't remember. The script was really done before I came in. I didn't give notes. I wasn't asked to give notes. It was just sort of, here's the script. You want to do this movie? But I do remember. I think I did remember him on the set, you know?
Yeah, I'm just fascinated by him too. Also, Leonard Goldberg.
Yeah.
Was he around a lot when you were working?
Yeah, he was around. I mean, it really, really kind of fell under him. He, you know, he sort of was the one that produced, I mean, he produced this.
Right.
So it wasn't me producing it, even though it sort of fell into that deal I had. No, he was the guy, and he continued on for decades. I mean, he's like one of the gods of television.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
Did you get to know him at all, or was he just sort of...
Just a little bit, you know, just kind of hanging, you know, which is always nice and polite and friendly. And but it wasn't like we stayed close friends, you know. Often, sure. Sometimes you do, you stay close friends, you know, forever. And most of the time, that's not necessarily what happens.
Yeah. You know, I met Amanda Weiss, who is in the beginning of the film. It was either the first thing she did or one of the first things she did. And she said that when she was cast... Candy Spelling, Aaron Spelling's wife, took her out to buy stockings for the role. She, you know, she wears these short shorts. She told me the story about hanging out with Candy Spelling. And was Aaron Spelling, do you remember seeing him around?
I don't remember seeing him around. I don't. And I ended up, you know, like shooting stars. I ended up with Aaron a lot, even, you know, on Melrose Place and
that's right.
Savannah and Models Inc. and all those shows that I worked with. I worked with him a lot. I didn't know he was involved. Was it through Spelling Productions or something? Or
I don't think so, but she told me the story, so that's why I made a note of it, because it was it was curious to me, and it's a really great story. She loved Candy Spelling, and they spent a day shopping, you know. And I just don't know if he was there, and she offered to help or what, but she just had mentioned him to me, and so.
Yeah.
And I know he worked a lot with Leonard Goldberg, so I thought, maybe there's a Spelling connection there I don't know of.
I don't remember seeing Spelling at all during the shoot, at least me.
Okay. And so just a couple more questions. So. So I'm glad you rewatched the movie, at least most of it. And I'm just curious, like, what your thoughts are of This House Possessed, like 40 years later. What do you think of the film?
Delighted that people still like it and ask about it. I mean, really. I mean, there's so much, so many films that have been made just in these 40 years. If there's any kind of connection to it like that, it's really great. And I'm grateful that it's campy, but it's not way out there campy. It's not super silly campy. It's sort of what's going on. And that's because I think the director just made choices that kind of kept it in this kind of this category that makes it work all these years later, you know?
Did you watch it when it originally aired?
Yeah, and there probably was a screening. I mean, usually there was a screening for those things, and then they had press come, and, you know, people do a red carpet thing.
Oh, fun.
In fact, I do remember a screening, and I remember breaking into a cold sweat as soon as I started to sing.
I knew you were going to say that.
Some big theater on Sunset Boulevard, and I was like, oh, this is rough. This is rough. I remember that. And I think that's really the only time I've really broken into a cold sweat about my work. I've heard people talk about that. I've never had that before, but I remember at that screening just going, oh boy.
I think you're being so hard on yourself for your singing.
Think I'm being too hard.
I don't know. But I mean, I think it's the song that everybody is. I think it's the lyrics to Sensitive You're Not, you know, that people are like, okay, what is this? You know, but I would, and the way you break into it too, like everybody's just waiting for him to do Sensitive You're Not, like all the people at the concert, they're just like, he's going to do it. And it's going to be like the headliner. And I can't wait.
I remember. The staging of it and coming in and being said, well, you're going to stand here in the middle. All these people are going to be around you. And they're all your fans. And I'm thinking, if they're really my fans, wouldn't they be like mobbing me? Wouldn't I be on a stage be trying to touch me or get my, yeah. Really? They're just going to stand back while I stand. I thought, this doesn't make sense to me. And I think it really was just a question of, well, you can surround me with people and it will look like there are thousands of people there. Right. You've got 20. I think it really was probably just a logistical, how do I shoot this thing, than anything that made any sense at all.
Was there any like choreography to that? Because I know there must be sort of when you pass out, but like there's a little bit of dancing right before.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think anybody was helping me.
They just threw you out to the wolves and said, do it.
I think I was just hung out to dry. It'll be okay. We're going to be close. No one's going to know. And they were close. It was a big wide shot. and that physicality is part of what makes the difference between someone who really is a singer and they're comfortable on stage. I mean, The Voice is one of my favorite shows. I watch The Voice all the time because I'm just fascinated about people's ability to quickly assimilate gifts and skills about what their performance is. But you can tell right away when someone steps on stage and they're physically comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, I'm comfortable on stage in a straight role, but to come out and start moving around to sing. So you probably noticed that with all the musicals that I did following that and all the times that I got up and sang and performed, that was sort of the gestational role of those roles that came afterwards.
I love it. And I guess you sort of answered my last question. Are you surprised that this film 40 years later has taken on a cult status?
Totally. Yeah, totally. Totally, because I forget. I really, really, honestly. I mean, I'm just trying to get through the day. Just trying to get through the day. Just trying not to get COVID. You know, yeah. Just trying to stay healthy. Trying to stay well and happy, and be a good friend and be a good dad. And so the last thing I'm doing is I forget. People will come and give me a picture to sign. I'm like, oh,
I remember.
You know,
I think the thing about This House Possessed too, that is a testament to what a great film it really is that it's never had a legitimate home video release, and yet it has survived all this time in people's minds as this film that they loved. And I know some of them, now it's a little more accessible with YouTube and bootlegging and things like that. And not that I condone that, but it's easier to see now. But for a long time, it, like, just real briefly, I'll just tell you my history with it. So I saw it when it originally aired. It was a big deal at our house. And the next day, everybody was talking about the blood shower. That was the big thing. And we couldn't believe it. And then a couple years later, it started to rerun on TBS every Halloween. And so there was a little stretch of time where from like the late 80s into like the mid 90s, it was guaranteed to come on TV every year at least. And then that kind of ended when they started switching up their programming. And so I was left with a really bad VHS copy of it, taped off TV, that I couldn't even barely see the image because it was just such a bad recording. And I watched that for years until I could find a better copy of it, which I had to get off eBay. And there's not really like a perfect copy that I can find available anywhere. Yet, despite that, and I have a feeling that if the movie ever does come out on DVD or Blu-ray, which I hope one day happens, that people will see what a beautiful film it really is. And I don't know how well you remember, well, I guess you rewatched it, but there's a scene, maybe it's the scene where you're practicing Play Me Like a Song, and you get your headache before Tanya shows up. And the gate opens and the camera pans in to you. And it's one of the most beautiful shots I've seen in a TV movie, the way it flows and the doors just kind of ghostly open as it lets the camera into the house. And I think a better quality release of that would really bring home. And you could tell me more, but it feels like there was a lot of care taken into the film in terms of like the visuals are very startling. And I wish people would be able to see it properly, but they can't. And even though they can't, we're all still like, so one of the people that I talked to 10 years ago when I did the 10 year anniversary, she made her sister a napkin where she embroidered you singing Sensitive You're Not. And I'll send you a photo of it. It's literally a picture of you that she embroidered on a napkin because her and her sister loved the movie. And that's the kind of effect it's had on people, right? And so here we are 40 years later, no home video. And yet I mean, maybe I'm the loudest voice of it, but like we're all still talking about it. And so there's no question to that. That was just sort of a long-winded statement to say, I'm so pleased that over the years I've been able to find people like myself to talk about this movie with and to share how much we love it. And people are still discovering it thanks to the internet. And it has survived. I don't know. Obviously, I think everybody will always think of the Hardy Boys. And probably Stroker Ace, maybe, when they think of you. But I think that this is high up for some of your most memorable filmmaking.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. And that's really sweet, all the things you just said.
All true.
Most of the time when we work as actors, especially, I don't do a lot of theater, which where you have that, you have a real audience right there responding. My work has really been television and film. And usually you're on location or you're in a studio and you're just doing the work, and the audience and the people that are seeing it in real time are the crew. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's a visitor on the set, but usually it's just whoever you're working with. And as you go from project to project, you're just doing the work. And that the sense of how an audience necessarily receives a project for me has always been very separate. You know, it's always been surprising. Because my experience of it is I go to work and I work through the day and you do your work and do your job and you go home and do the best you can and hopefully connect with it personally. But the audience reaction has always been very separate for me. Mm. Even the Hardy Boys, when that took off, we were working away. And then one day I went to McDonald's and I ordered a burger and people were screaming. It was like, what is this? So that's really sweet. I mean, I appreciate that because it really feels in some ways very separate. And yet, and also a really nice validation of just the effort spent working, you know, and trying to do a decent job. So thank you.
No, absolutely. And I mean, everything I've seen you in has been great, but obviously this is the movie I hold closest to my heart. But it's just been so great to get a little bit of backstory on it and to hear you talk about it sounds like it was a pretty friendly set and pretty amicable and fun.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, and absolutely.
Great. So it's a good memory. I think those are all my questions. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to add about making the film.
A lot of times movies that you work on, like an example is when I did a movie called Lifeguard. Yes. I was in college and I got, you know, cast in that. And so I went out and I worked on it for 10 days and went back to college and scrambled through my midterm exams, which I hadn't, of course, prepared for because I was making a movie. And then that turned out to be this really lovely little movie. I mean, lovely little movie. And it was just a job. You know? This House Possessed is one of those movies that, okay, this could be fun. This would be interesting. You know, and I like Lisa and I was excited about William Ware, the director and all that. But then it actually becomes something other than what my sense of it was, is really the surprise of it. And there were things I thought were going to be huge and no. They disappear. So I've learned not to prejudge too much something, to go for it, go in optimistically and do the best you can. And then all the other factors kick in, the timing, the marketing, the budget, the people involved. I mean, you know, you go make Michael Douglas make China Syndrome. And then, you know, a week later, you know, Three Mile Island melts down. You know, there's a lot of serendipity in all of it. So when something actually continues to have a life of its own, it's pretty amazing.
Cool. Yay. Okay. So thank you so much, Parker Stevenson, for joining me on this interview. I appreciate it so much. You're not everything I wanted you to be. You're not used to giving a lot. It's all for one act scenario with you, cause sensitive you're not. Ain't gonna feel no more. About how much you care. What a joke. Your sensitivity. Hey guys, I just slept all the way from Sausalito to do this podcast. So I really hope you're excited to be here just like me, because we are talking about my all-time favorite TV movie, This House Possessed, on the anniversary of its release, which is February 6, 1981. That means This House Possessed has turned a beautiful, well-aged 40 this year. Just to give you a little bit of context for why I'm doing this year, you know, 10 years ago when I was blogging a lot, I actually decided to do a 30-year anniversary of This House Possessed, and a bunch of people sent in little like posts for me to share about why they love the movie so much. And there was quite a few people. And, you know, at that time, I thought that I was kind of alone in my love of this film. I mean, to the passion, the sort of passionate love that I have for it. I know people like the movie. It was really nice, and I made friends, and there was some bonding, and it was great. And so as the 40th anniversary started to come around, I thought, what can I do this year? Well, I'm not so much blogging anymore, but I do have a podcast. And wouldn't it be fun if we all sat around and talked about the movie and gave it a little love and shared it with people? And hopefully those who haven't seen the movie and are listening will check it out. And those who have seen it maybe will enjoy having us reminisce about it. But I got a little ambitious, and I thought, what if I asked Parker Stevenson to talk about the movie? And so I contacted him, and I'd met him a few years ago, and he actually gave me his business card, and he said if I wanted to talk to him about his TV movies to drop him a line. And I was always too afraid to, because I love him, I love him, I love him. And I decided, why not, you know? And he was really sweet. He contacted me back and said, let's get together and do a Zoom chat and we'll talk about the movie. And so I spent this afternoon, a lovely, beautiful, bright blue, amazing afternoon, talking to the first boy I ever loved and the star of my favorite TV movie. And so, and he couldn't have been more charming or sweeter or more thoughtful. And so I'm really happy. And so you will have heard that first. And now here we are to talk about the movie. And so let me introduce my co-host, which I should have done before I went into my little intro, but I'm still shell-shocked from sitting in my kitchen looking at Parker Stevenson and having him answer my questions about This House Possessed. It was the most exciting thing that ever happened. Okay. Hey, Dan, what's up?
We shouldn't have done this episode. We shouldn't have done this episode.
Why?
I was going to actually, I was trying to decide how to say hello to you. And I thought I'd do Margaret rather than saying, oh. Amanda, Amanda, sensitive you are.
Yeah,
that's I couldn't sweet. Decide which one to do. I thought I'd do the Margaret because I love that crazy lady in this film who constantly looks like she's about to pull a Scooby-Doo and rip a mask off or something like that. She's great.
Yeah, that was Joan Bennett we're talking about. And we'll probably talk about her makeup job in this film in a minute. And we're also joined here by Nate. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hey, not much. Although I think the house that's possessed was kind of a cool house.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Agreed.
I will say one of the things that Parker Stevenson and I talked about was the house. And he did an interview. So the only piece of production history that really exists on This House Possessed is an interview that Parker Stevenson did that appeared in several newspapers, like the Associated Press or somebody did it, and they syndicated it. And different parts of the interview show up in different papers. And one of the things he talked about was that one of the things that drew him to making the film was them shooting it in this house, because he was an architecture major in college, and the house fascinated him because it was contemporary and really amazing. And it was, I can't remember the word he used, but he was talking about like how mammoth the house itself was. And they shot a lot of the film inside the house. So those interiors are from the film. And believe it or not, the exterior at the end of the film is also at the house. Like they shot the fire and the house together. And he'll talk a little bit about how they did that. So I thought maybe they built some kind of weird set, because it looks like they're burning down the house at the end of the film. But no, they were able to shoot it on the set. And so anyway, he talked a little bit about that. And I think the house has been a big draw for a lot of people who remember the film, because it's so unlike any house I think any of us have ever seen. And so we will talk about that. But anyway, I'm already going off on 1,000 different tangents. My brain is here and there because it's been quite a This House Possessed afternoon. So let's just go briefly into what the movie's about. So I'm just going to use my book here, and I'm not going to read my review, but there at the beginning of every review is a little like 20-word synopsis of the film. And we'll just start there. I have a feeling most people listening are probably already associated with the movie, but if not, it might be a little spoiler, and I probably spoiled it when I said the house burns down. But there may be some other spoilers, so you may want to listen to this after you see the movie. But I highly recommend either way you seek this film. It's a lot of fun. So here's just the general synopsis of it. A convalescing pop star and his nurse discover their dream home is less than perfect when it starts disposing of its visitors. And that's basically what the film is. And, yeah. You know, I mean, briefly, it's about a guy who hires out a nurse to help him while he's recuperating from having a breakdown at his concert and singing the infamous Sensitive You're Not, which I know we will talk about. And they end up just randomly at this house, but it's actually not so randomly because this movie is actually like, it's two love triangles, right? It's the love triangle between the nurse that the pop star hires. So Parker Stevenson is Gary Strellhorn, I think is how you say the last name. And Lisa Eilbacher is Sheila/Margaret. And she goes by the name Sheila through most of the film. They meet and they go to the house, but then they are greeted by, I guess they meet her earlier on, by Tanya, right? Who is the craziest, campiest supermodel you've ever met. She wears crazy fur boas and she sleeps all the way from Sausalito and she's kind of mean to Lisa Eilbacher and she pops pills while she listens to Gary play ballads. And so that's the first love triangle. But the second love triangle is between the house and Gary and Sheila. And that's might be the more interesting love triangle in a way, because it's very similar in that it's jealous and it's bitchy and it's emotional like Tanya, but it's also a lot more vengeful than she is. And so the whole point of the film is, why is the house in the middle of this love triangle, right? And what is it about Sheila that it's so fascinated by? And why is she always being called Margaret? So that's like the general mystery of the film, right? That we have to unfold as it goes along. I told Parker Stevenson this, and I don't know if it's going to end up in the interview or not, because I gave a little precursor to it, or I talked about it at some point. But I saw this movie when it originally aired. It was a big deal because he was in it and because it was a horror film. And I told him that in 1981, and my parents weren't like, hey, let's go see Friday the 13th, sweetheart. They were like, no, you can't see that. But if it's on TV, they thought, well, it must be okay to watch, you know, and watch all the horror movies you want that are made for TV. And so that was my exposure to the horror genre. And it was a gateway to me. And I'd already been watching several horror movies on television at this point, because I saw Gargoyles and Don't Be Afraid of the Dark when I was like 4 years old. So this is a few years after that. And so it was this combination of one of my favorite actors and a horror movie. And I remember the next day, it aired on Friday night. And the next day, me and the kid who lives down the street from me, his name was Steve, we met up and we were like, dude, did you see the blood shower? That was bad. You know, that was kind of us at 10. And then the movie would rerun on TBS when I got older and I'd watch it there. And then I started picking up bootlegs of it. And every bootleg was slightly better than the one I got before it, because my first copy of it was almost unwatchable. But I watched it 100 times anyway. And so this has been a movie that's been a big part of my life for a long time. I've always loved it. It's a comfort film for me now because it brings back a lot of memories for me. And I know that there's a fine line between nostalgia and film criticism, but I do think that this film has a lot to offer now, and it's a worthy film in the history of the TV movie. I don't think Dan and Nate saw this when it originally aired. Am I right?
Right. You are right.
I think Nate would have been 0 or 1 or something anyway. So he may have seen it and just doesn't remember. But I'm curious, do you guys remember the first time you saw it and what you originally thought of it? Let's start with Dan.
Yes, it was, I want to say it was August or September 2015, I think. And it was for a podcast I do called The Made for TV Mayhem Show. And the woman who's on the podcast with myself and Nate, I knew it was her favorite film and that she was going to pick it, so I watched it. So that's where I first saw it. I first saw it for our very first episode of this show.
Wow.
5 years ago.
Or so. And?
Oh, I remember. I think I actually listened to a bit of the episode. And we talk a bit about it, so I'll try and I'll probably repeat myself. I apologize to anyone who has heard that. But I quite enjoy it. I watched it once for that time and twice for this. Ooh. And so I quite enjoy it. There it's nice because there are little bits here and there that I didn't catch the first time. And I love the model character. She's great because the first time I watched the movie, I loved her. schlepping around and everything. And she was the one, I think we talked about, because, you know, Slim Pickens is in this. So you put Slim Pickens in a movie, it automatically gets elevated several levels. And she has the moment where she arrives at the house. And she references, I wrote the last time we talked about it, I wrote it down, and it was, she mentions Mr. something or other, tracer of lost pop stars or something like that. You know, how did you find me? Oh, I just talked to your manager, Mr. whatever, tracer of lost pop stars, which is a reference to, that's not quite what she says, but it's a reference to Mr. Keen, tracer of lost persons, which was a not very good, but entertaining, like 1940s, 1950s radio show about a guy who found missing people.
How you doing? I got goodies for you. Woo! Now, don't get started. I know you volunteered to be alone, but I couldn't help myself. I just had to see you.
Tanya, how did you find me?
Your manager, Mr. Keen, tracer of lost singers. I told him I'd turn off his pacemaker if he didn't give me your address.
And so I remember when I first watched it, I love that she mentioned that she somehow, this pill-popping, crazy, slightly crazy model, made an immediate reference to a 1940s radio show. And it's weird, though, because two of the times I watched it, I loved her. And then one of the times I didn't, because she's mean to Lisa Eilbacher.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get over it. I don't know why that was, but I won't tell you whether it was the second or third time I watched it. But one of the times I was like, I don't like you, and I cannot wait for you to take a shower. And that's I think it's nicely set up as I love the concept of the house watching over us all kind of thing. And some, I don't know how the house assembles everything the way it does, but I really like this thought of this like computer or whatever it is sitting at the center of this house, this force or whatever, just controlling everything and bringing everything into line, and all the TV monitors go on when it wants to see something, and then it's making phones ring, and it's attacking Amanda Weiss with a hose, you know, and it's just, I love all these little moments. And too, the fact that you think Parker Stevenson seems to be the main character in the beginning, but he's actually not. And it becomes less of the main character as the film goes along, although he's still hunky. Don't get me wrong. But I think it's a lot of fun. You know me, my favorite era of TV movies is before this. And this is starting to wander into the area where I think of TV movies mainly as being a miniseries. But I quite like this one. And it's got some rather violent moments and some good creepy bits and some nice relationship moments, and it moves at a nice pace, and I think it resolves itself nicely. Although I did, for some reason this time when I was watching Joan Bennett's character, I did keep thinking she was going to say something like, at one point, like, Margaret, you shouldn't have come here because the person who designed the house doesn't want you here, and I'm the person who designed the house. And she pulls off a mask and suddenly is a man or something like that. You know, that's what I kept thinking because of her makeup this time. I don't know why.
It makes sense because it's a crazy makeup job. Like it's jarring.
And it's strange too, because she pushes this shopping cart around. They said, you know, she goes to some shack where she has all the garbage, but like the place she lives on is, it reminded me of, I don't know if you've ever seen the second X-Files movie, which I'm now forgetting the name of. It's the one where they're hunting down some, it's the second one. And when Scully goes to see Mulder lives like in a building in a house in the middle of nowhere that looks a lot like where that lady lives.
Yes, right.
I thought, does Mulder live? Is that Mulder investigating something early on in his career? Overall, I think I would not say it's my one of my favorites, but it's quite good. And I did enjoy watching it twice over the past like 3 days.
Awesome. Nate, do you remember the first time you saw this house possessed?
I don't. It's been a really long time though ago. It's been a many air ago. But I will say that the couple in the beginning, they were a little more afraid of a water hose than I probably would have been.
Yeah.
But now nothing was holding the hose, so I guess, you know, that might have been scary. Tanya's my favorite character in the movie. I absolutely adore her. I think she is amazing. And I know she's mean, I know, but she just reminds me of, like, you know, like an Erica Kane, like, kind of diva from, like, a soap opera. And I'm like, yeah. I just love it. I love it. That campiness is amazing. I did feel bad for her when she had to get the blood shower. I know that you know, messed up her hair and stuff. So it's not really good.
I want to know why there's not more Tanya cosplay in this world, because I think that, like, fur thing she wears around her neck when she first shows up and the, yeah, like, those pants and her, I mean, I really feel like we could make the most of Tanya's wardrobe in this film if we really put our hearts and minds in it.
I like how she just wasn't, she's definitely not afraid to speak her mind and say whatever she is thinking, yeah, because her first encounter with the nurses, I mean, she's being mean right off the bat, pretty much. Like, and like the nurse or Lisa Albarker's character was just like, well, you can schlep back home for a couple more days. Which I thought was funny.
What do you mean I can't see Gary?
I'm sorry, miss, but those are the doctor's orders.
Fine, you follow them. Me, I'm going to see Gary.
Miss, you can't go in there.
Watch me. What's the trouble?
I told her she couldn't see Mrs. Bayhorn, and she won't pay any attention.
Look, I'm a good friend of Gary's, and I just schlepped all the way in from Sausalito.
Well, then I suggest you schlep all the way back, at least for two more days.
Hey, Florence Nightingale, I'm going into bed.
Oh, no, you're not.
You planning on stopping?
No.
Not me, him.
And you know something? I think he'd enjoy it almost as much as I would.
I love the scene where the gate's crushing the car.
Yes.
Yes.
That's really
yes.
cool. That was a very cool moment. But yeah, I and the house itself, I think, is very fun, because to me, it's like the house is a character,
yes,
in the movie in and of itself. It's sort of like how the car in Christine is a character.
Yeah.
Just like this house is, because the house, you know, loves Margaret, as it were. But anyway, no, I really enjoy the film. I think you both already know that my favorite made-for-TV movie is still Home for the Holidays.
Yeah.
But This House Possessed is a lot of fun. I think it moves by at a pretty brisk pace. There's not a lot of downtime, really. I mean, even when nothing like scary is necessarily going on, I mean, come on, you've got Tanya to hang out with. And her, like totally I'm better than you attitude that she has. Now, the actress that played Tanya, have either of you seen Class Reunion?
I have seen it, but National not for Folks? A long time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I just watched that recently. Is that? Oh, yeah, that's her, the blonde.
I was
yeah.
about to ask you, is that her?
Yes.
Okay.
It is. Okay. Wow. Okay.
Okay. I was just curious because I love that movie. I don't want to go off on a tangent, but just as a quick side note, I always love the scene where they sing "Stop in the Name of Love" together.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed This House Possessed, and I knew we were going to cover it or discuss it, you know, in depth eventually.
So. Yeah, I know. I'm yes. kind of glad I held off on it, because I think it'll be nice to have this like special kind of tribute to it on its 40th anniversary. I can't believe it's 40 years old. It's been so amazing. I can remember the first viewing like it was yesterday. But something you said about her and Class Reunion, the actress's name is Shelley Smith. And what's interesting, and I asked Parker about it, I don't think he knew her very well, but like, you know, she only acted for like a decade. And then she dropped out and she's working in like, she owned a surrogacy company for a while. She would help women have babies. And she also, I think, was a family counselor. And I don't know if she's doing either still, but she has a really interesting personal life, and you can look her up and stuff. But I was shocked when I saw that when I was prepping for this episode. I didn't pull a lot of background up. I just got some basics, but I looked her up, and she literally acted from like 1979 to something like 1991 or 1990. And for me, Shelley Smith was so prevalent on television in that decade that I thought she'd been acting for like four decades. You know what I mean? And she did so much. As a matter of fact, I'm closing my eyes and I can see her in a Magnum PI. I remember her from A Heart to Heart. She was in all kinds of stuff. She just popped up for a decade. She just filled the screen. And so it was interesting that she's been not acting for so long, because to me, she's been acting this whole time, because I guess because I watch a lot of retro TV, I just see her constantly. And she's great in everything. She's stunning. I think she started as a model, obviously. She's pretty tall, too. And she's just a scenery chewer in this. I don't think she's like this in everything. And she just commands the screen when she comes on in the scenes that she's in. But one of the things I wrote in my review that I kind of like looked back on and thought, yeah, I think I still feel that way, is that I talk about how the house literally spits her out. You know what I mean? Like, he does it, he wants to get rid of her, and so, or he, it, wants to get rid of her, and it feels like it's literally spitting her out of the house. And it's amazing that she survives. I think it partially has to do, or it has less to do with the house wanting to kill people who are interested in Gary as much as it wants to kill the people who might reveal the secret of who Sheila is. So I think that the house wants to keep the secret more than anything else. Although he does act like it, I keep calling him he, it acts like it's playing matchmaker too, right? Because at the beginning of the film, you know, it's watching Gary singing and it feels like it's orchestrating the breakdown so that he'll end up at the hospital with Sheila. And I guess it's predestined because they go to that place to look at the blueprints, the archives, and they open up the blueprint and the house is theirs. Do you remember that when they're after the funeral? And so it's like, it's really interesting, but so I guess the only reason why she survived was that she wasn't a threat to the actual secret. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. That was my thought.
Yeah, that's the best I could.
So what you're saying is this house is smart.
It's super smart. And
very calculating.
I think she's being mean to Margaret or Sheila. And so
that's not good.
So eject her out of there. Whereas the librarian actually knows something.
Yeah.
And that's why she has to be burned to death so horribly. It reminded me of like Meg Ryan. Is it Meg Ryan, which in Amityville 3D?
Yeah.
Is she the one who gets burned horribly in the car?
Oh, is that Candy Clark? Is it Candy?
Oh, was that? I'm sorry. Was it Candy Clark?
I think I can't remember now.
Ages. Yeah. But who? Yeah. The scene in Amityville 3D where like the woman gets horribly, horribly burned in the car. The scene in this one reminded me of that, and I thought that's horrible. That's a horrible way to die. Trapped in the car, just burning to death with people stabbed. Depressed the heck out of myself. Sorry, I'm gonna back away.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up that scene because when I rewatched this movie for this episode, I was thinking how of all the murders, that one's the most harrowing to me because they keep cutting to her in the car screaming, and it's really freaky because it really puts you in her place in a lot of ways, and for to have that on TV is really shocking to me. I used to think that the old lady, the bag lady's death, was the most horrifying because the way she falls in the pool and her makeup is so strange, and you can see her face underwater. But it's really, it's Kay Callan in the car that's like so upsetting to me. And the other death I love, I guess there's three in it, right?
Oh yeah,
Is Slim Pickens' death because I love the breathing mirror.
Yes,
that's and I, nice, and it's also really shocking that when he gets killed by the shard of glass, you see it.
Yes, it's pretty brutal.
Yeah, it is.
For 1981.
Well, wasn't it a little unfair though, because he just wanted to fix it?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
It was totally unfair. I would say most of the deaths were unfair, no, Nate. I mean, I might say.
Although that. I will say that the drowning death, that woman, what is her name? Does she have?
I think she's just a bag lady, yeah.
Okay. She scared me.
Yeah.
I found her to be very scary and creepy.
Yeah.
If I was, you know, Sheila and she was coming up to me like that, I would be like, oh my goodness, who are you? Please, please, please go away. You're scaring the heck out of me.
Did you know that was Joan Bennett?
No, I didn't. Isn't she from Dark Shadows?
Yeah. And Suspiria.
Yeah.
And I was thinking when Dan was talking about her, I think the makeup for the filmmakers was probably kind of important because Joan Bennett's so beautiful in real life. Mm-hmm. And she aged beautifully. I mean, she was just a beautiful woman. And I just, maybe they just thought she wasn't scary enough, but the way the makeup has been like sort of layered on top of layers, it looks like it's really just disturbing. You know, it's just, there's so many things about this movie. And the other thing that I noticed, it has night scenes and deaths that happen at night, but a lot of the film also takes place in daylight, which I really love. And and I always love horror movies that are kind of bold enough to let things unravel in the daytime. And so like, but those moments are more toned down. So like some of my favorite scenes in the movie are like Well, first of all, she brushes her hair a lot, and it made me think of Psycho Cop. Do you remember the girl in Psycho Cop who's constantly brushing her hair?
Yeah.
It made me think of her because she's brushing her hair while she's walking through town at one point, and I'm like, really, Sheila? Mm-hmm. But like, she wears an awful lot of yellow, and we can talk about that later. But she but she is brushing her hair, and she hears her name, or she hears the name Margaret. And she goes, and there's that doll. It's just a Raggedy Ann doll in the closet.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And then the screen kind of lights up real bright, and then it goes to its regular color again. And I love that. It's such a simple thing, but it really sets the tone of like the film, you know? And so it's got all these brutal moments, but it also has a lot of really nice, just creepy things happening,
yes,
you know, throughout the film.
I always love when horror movies set, you know, up scenes like during the day. Some of my favorite horror movie scenes actually take place in the daytime. You know, like the ice skating scene in Curtains. I mean, that's daytime, but I mean, it's just as scary to me. And in this movie, I mean, the water hosing took place in the day.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, she got sprayed. Now, you said that was Amanda Weiss.
Weiss, yeah, it is.
Isn't it? Yes.
Yep.
Weiss, very cool. Very cool. I did not know that. I learned something every episode.
Yay. Oh, I'm sorry. I just real briefly, I met her too, and she signed my script, but I didn't get a chance to contact her for this episode, but I'd like to have her on because we talked about her after school specials and stuff. But she told me, and Parker Stevenson said he didn't remember seeing Aaron Spelling on the set, but Candy Spelling supposedly took her shopping for the nylons that she wears under her shorts, and that they spent a day shopping, and she told me Candy Spelling was amazing. So that's the story she told me about This House Possessed.
I was going to say one of my horror movies I absolutely love, The Redeemer, Class Reunion.
Oh, that's right.
Takes place during, I mean, every time they cut outside, they show the outside of the building, it's generally, I think it's daylight the whole time. I don't think the sun ever goes down. Yeah, they don't, because during that, right at the end there, when the lawyer's in the library.
Daytime.
It's daytime. Yep. It's like daytime the whole time, which is really great because the place is so dark. But all the windows, this light kind of seeps in. It's a great.
It's very unnerving to me.
It is.
It's a hell of a film. Yeah, hell of a weird film. Yeah.
And I like daylight. I'm thinking of a bunch of them now. But also, what it made me think of was I believe it's called. It's got two titles. I think it's The House That Screamed, right, with Robin Strasser.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, that house is so strange to me. It's nothing like this house. It's not as opulent. It's big. But I don't know if you guys remember, the thing about that house that really got to me is that it's located in sort of this patch of grass where there's no road to get to the house. So I don't know how people get to it. And I guess you just park down the road and you walk up. But it really like disturbed me for some reason, because the house is just kind of exists in this weird place.
Right,
the house is
in the space. Yeah.
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 And the thing about This House Possessed that I like is that it's so big that you're never quite sure what room you're in. Like, she's walking through halls, and one of the halls looks like it's kind of outside, like she's walking by columns and she could be outdoors. And then there's another hall that's really long in the house, and it's really upsets your sense of space. And it does a really good job of doing that. Like that house. So the house was designed by a guy named Fred Briggs, and I was looking him up today, and I didn't pull a bio on him or anything, but it looks like the house that they shot this in went for sale in 2018. And they reduced the price. It was originally like $82.5 million. And then they lowered it to $28.5, which makes it much more affordable. And I think I'm going to put a bid on it. But, you know, but like there were some beautiful pictures of the house. And I believe it's the same house. And it's got the indoor pool and those really long hallways. And there's just something really neat about the house. And I love taking a movie that's got like a old school gothic kind of story, because there's literally a scene of her in her nightgown walking through like a windy night that's very old school gothic.
Cat in the Canary,
but it's done in this really modern house, and so it's kind of creating also like a sense of unease with that, because you're watching something that should be in a Victorian house in this like totally upscale creation. And so it's really playful with its tropes, right? Because it's doing things that you think should be happening at night, and it's also like doing things that should be happening in a different type of house, and it's playing with these ideas to update them for the 80s, you know, it would become really obsessed with technology as we're moving kind of into the computer age, right? Mm-hmm. And so, because there's this great Charlie's Angels, it was in the fifth season, and I don't remember the whole story, but I think there was like a computer, and it was like hypnotizing you or something like that. Do you remember this one?
No.
I can't remember, but the computer was involved in doing some kind of mind control or something like that, if I remember correctly. And so there was stuff like that happening in the early 80s that was really fascinating. Like, what is technology going to do to us that mm-hmm. may seem really quaint
yeah.
now, but not... then.
It was that weird space where they thought like computers, what are computers going to do? They're going to do everything. And some respects they do, but not quite in the way we thought.
Yeah.
I always think of what I was thinking of during this sometimes, and this is maybe not quite right, but the movie Nightmare Weekend, which has this crazy computer that controls this house and does. And there were a couple moments where I thought when Slim Pickens was going to get killed, I thought like at one point, like, you know, because in Nightmare Weekend, the computer turns objects into these little silver balls and they fly in your mouth. I know that sounds a little weird. And they turn you into like zombies for a split second when the mirror was vibrating. I thought like the glass of booze that like Slim Pickens had or something nearby him was going to turn into one of those little silver balls. The only thing this is missing in Nightmare Weekend, conduit for the computer is a little hand puppet named George. And my dog just looked at me because his name is George. I know George, not you. But I was hoping at the end of the movie there'd be just a moment where you saw like a little hand puppet looking at the TV screens and hitting some little buttons or something like that. But one of the things I love about 80s movies is this, like in like the 60s and 70s, when you had computers, there were these huge, you know, the reel-to-reel things filling up rooms, and they were things like Demon Seed and HAL in 2001. But then when the 80s hit and you got personal computers and stuff like that, there was just all these wonderful movies were just like, computers could do anything, you know? And it's just, you know, I type this, like, it's crazy. You know what, what I mean? It's just like, it's just so much fun to think of what we thought they were going to do as compared to what they can do. Mm. And, This is a fun one to think that because you keep expecting maybe that there'll be a moment where you see someone behind it, or maybe even like you'll see like when the movie ends, like you'll see like one of the screens as everything's on fire, and then the camera will pull back in a room and you'll see like maybe in an old chair like a skeleton or something,
yeah, sitting in a chair, awesome,
or something like that, like this spirit that's been controlling, but it isn't, it's the house, it's the computers, I think, that are doing, I don't know, but that's one of the fun things of the film.
It made me think of Electric Dreams, because you know, Electric Dreams is an amazing film, but like in that movie the computer falls in love with Virginia Madsen, but for the computer, which is becoming more human through love, has to finally reach that apex of humanity by letting her go, right? I mean, that's what the crux of that film is about what does it mean to love and to let go, and that's what makes us people and human. This movie doesn't do that, but it's interesting that the house, they call it This House Possessed, but the house isn't really possessed by anybody. It's a living organism that's separate, right, from humans, and it's not really a spirit. It's the house. I don't know how else to describe it. The house is a living organism. And like an
artificial intelligence kind of somehow, yeah, or something possibly. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's also, but somehow along the way it's developed emotion, but it supposedly developed the emotion because it was so loved that it learned love and then it fed it back. Right. But then that love became, it was like, it's like a teenager in a way, because it's like so emotional about everything that happens, right? Like it's going,
yeah,
you know, it's really,
I like that, yeah,
it's really bitchy, like it loves so much that it's super sensitive to everything, and then that's what kind of feeds it into doing these things without thinking, that's a bad idea, house, you probably shouldn't do that.
And I like it if they made one like This House Possessed again or something, this house, you know, 20 years later, maybe the computer would have matured and would be like an adult or something like that. Maybe it'd been less of like, you know, like the moment the two of them start fooling around in bed, you know, it starts phones ringing and all sorts of things happening to the, you know, knock it off. But I like the thought if there were a sequel and maybe they rebuilt on the space, you know, they built a new house on it and the spirit came back. And now it was an adult. It was a grown-up spirit. And maybe it was vengeful. Maybe it was more fun. Maybe, but less sort of like a petulant teen, but more mature adult. Although most adults I know are pretty
petulant. But what if it just smoked a lot and drank Tab?
What if it was like Archie Bunker, but a computer?
Eat it. And just sit down all the time.
Eat it.
Yeah.
Stifle it.
Yeah, it might, that's right. Yeah, that might not be as compelling. But like, but it's interesting because it's its own organism. And so it's fascinating to me because, like, for instance, like when I think of haunted houses, it's usually like a person that's inhabiting the house. Yes. Or a poltergeist of some kind. But this isn't necessarily a poltergeist. So it's a really interesting take on houses. On haunted houses. And it's fairly unique in that way.
You know what? I've written down here solar panels. There's that scene where the guy is fixing something at the house.
Feeny.
And he fixes the solar panels. And then when he kind of jumps down off from where he is, the camera kind of slowly pulls in on the panels. Mm. And you think, is it the sun? Is the sun doing this? I like the fact that it pulls in on it because I sat there going, why are you tracking in on the solar panels? I know that's where the house gets a lot of its energy from. So I guess that's important. But I felt like there was something else there. But I wasn't quite sure.
Oh, that's really interesting. Because, you know, one of the things I talked to Parker Stevenson about was some of the camera work. And I was really like into, there's this one scene every time I watch the movie, I'm just like, it's hypnotic to me. I'm going to compare it to a scene from Deep Red, Profundo Rosso here in a second. But only tangentially. So there's that scene when he's writing that song that he says is going to be our song to Sheila. When he gets this headache and the camera starts like sort of at the outside of the house and the gates just kind of open on their own and the camera just goes kind of pans down the hallway. Uh-huh. And then it goes to him playing the piano. And it's such a beautiful camera shot that it always makes me stop for a second. And all I want to do is just kind of live inside that camera shot. But you're right. It's showing these kind of moments where the house is sort of alive, right? Because the gates open on its own. And then I guess I never paid attention to the solar panels, but the idea of it tracking and trying to let you know that it's feeding on something, right?
Yes.
And so that's really interesting because that's a human thing. But what it made me think of is, you know, that scene in Profundo Rosso when he drops the needle on the record and then the camera kind of follows the record going around. Yeah. That's like, I could live inside that scene for the rest of my life. Yeah. It's just such an amazing camera shot. And this is, for me, it's the same thing. So, so I guess there's probably more camera shots like that I just haven't noticed that next time I'll pay more attention to, where it's trying to give us this sort of sense of it being alive. But I love that.
I love the concept. Yeah, that it's like it's doing these things. That if you catch it, you catch it. If you don't, you don't. It doesn't matter. But it's like because the house is in front of us the entire time. I was going to say, but since you can't see the house, but you can see the house the entire time. But to make it a character, it does all these little things and tracking on the solar panels and tracking it on slowly into mirrors and things like that. It's all these little bits, just like when the mirror cracks at the one point there, you know, it's all these little moments that are just kind of these cool things to say, there's another character here. You may not be able to see it, him, her, but there is another character here.
And he's super pissed off.
He's cheesed. He really likes Margaret, and why not? You know?
Yeah, she's lovely. You know,
it's better than having like, it's better than like, say if Margaret went back to like the house in Silent Night, Bloody Night, and there was a crazy person running around with an axe in there. You know, this is a little more subtle.
I wish my house loved me.
Maybe it does, Nate.
Yeah, you don't know.
Well, but you know, I've told it, you know, I love you, house, but it hasn't said anything back or killed anybody for me.
That's a disappointment.
You know,
that's a disappointment.
Have you had any relatives rush out, you know, at a moment's notice or anything like that? Or
no, nothing like that.
Oh, that's weird.
I know.
Keep an eye out for cameras tracking in on random portions of your house that you don't understand.
Well, I have left the hose alone, and I've checked the Ring camera because nobody was out there, just to see if it moved by itself. So far, no luck.
You need to get two horny teens to make out in front, though, because otherwise it won't do anything.
That's probably what's missing.
And I like to, if this were an R-rated film at the time or something like that, there's every good chance there would have been acid in the hose. But because it's
well, a TV know what? Movie, it's you just, know what you said though? If this scream, was an R-rated movie, if this was an R-rated movie, there would have been acid. And I thought you were just going to say ass. And I was like, okay, where are we going with this?
Yeah.
But why would they put acid in the hose? I mean, aren't you supposed to ingest that?
I don't know. True. Well, you could spray it on them like a shower, like in a Slaughter High or Island of Blood kind of.
Oh, you're talking about like burn the acid that burns.
Yes.
I got you.
I was gonna say, are you trying to put logic into it? Because they haven't added any logic to the TV movie version of it. So why would the theatrical? Although it does have its own strange sense of logic, I think what I like about it too is that it's not too convoluted. Like it's very much a love story, which is one of my favorite parts of it. I love the romance because Parker Simpson always was a great romantic lead, clearly. And he has a lot of chemistry with Lisa Eilbacher, who he'd worked with on the Hardy Boys, and they were friendly. And it's a nice romance, which I always appreciate. But then the only other thing that's going on in the movie is unraveling the mystery of the house. So it's not getting caught up in all this minutia or trying to like overwrite the story or anything like that. It's very much from point A to point B. And I love that. You can just sit back and kind of let it unfold, and it completely unfolds for you. So even though the story's crazy, it's not trying to create crazy logic to make it make sense. It's just letting it happen. And it's just letting you kind of fall into the universe of the film, which, you know, I think some films sometimes overthink their stuff that they know is crazy. And so they try to create science or something to make it more realistic. But sometimes you just need to like let the movie be the movie.
Yes.
Yeah. I just want it to be crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
do your thing.
And it works better that way. One of the things Parker Stevenson said was he thought it was kind of a campy film, but also that they played it straight. And I think that helps too. They took everything very seriously. And as a matter of fact, I was thinking, it occurs to me that she doesn't really even think about what's happening in the house outside of the murders, in that she's trying to figure out what the connections are, but they're at Slim Pickens' funeral. He starts to put stuff together. And I remember she's got her hand on her hip and she's like, what is the, you know what I mean? Like the way they start to like come to the idea that something is happening is very kind of organic, you know, and it's well done.
You know, in all the years we were together, I never told him that I loved him.
Oh, he knew.
What the hell is going on?
What are you talking about?
I just don't understand it.
You don't understand what?
I don't know. There's no pattern, no logic. Two people are dead.
Oh, honey, those were accidents.
Oh, come on. What happened to Arthur was no accident.
Yeah, but the police said...
I don't care what the police said. He didn't just fall into that mirror.
Well, he could have. He'd been drinking.
The coroner said there was barely any alcohol in his system.
Well, then how do you explain it?
I don't. Any more than I can explain what happened to Tanya? Or the librarian?
Gary, are you saying someone... somebody's doing this to us? Gary, who?
No one I know. Maybe someone you knew, an old boyfriend?
No, I didn't even leave a forwarding address. Nobody knows where I am.
Well, maybe it has something to do with whoever lived in that house before.
And their hands are kind of wrapped around each other's waists and things in a very elaborate fashion, which I like.
Did you think he had chemistry with Tanya?
Well, everybody has chemistry with her. Yeah. I mean, how could you not? She just, the way she walks. And she was scary. Like, she's one of those kind of women that I love and I'm terrified of it. She's like the Courtney Love of This House Possessed, you know? Like, like the woman who doesn't really have an off button or a sensor button. And she's great in small doses. But if, like, you had to spend more than, like, a day with her, you'd probably claw her eyes out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
She's the perfect, friend for brunch.
Yes.
We'll go out for brunch. We'll gossip, talk about, our love lives. and all that good stuff. She could tell me about Parker Stevenson.
One of the things I brought up to him that I thought was that I love is when he's playing that song for her. She's the way she's like got her back arched against the piano. She's popping the pills and everything. It's just so beautifully done. Like everything about that character is so big, and she plays it that way, and but doesn't do it to the point where she's obnoxious. She's never obnoxious. She's just terrifying because you know she's just going to say whatever's on her mind, and she's not always nice about it. And so like when she does these moments, they're so big, but they're also like really well done. You know, like the actress is so good in the part. I keep thinking about the part where, well, first of all, she's like, she tells Sheila, she's like, you know, my luggage is out there. Could you take it into my room? And you see Sheila carrying these giant heavy pieces of luggage, which is hilarious. It's a really cute little funny moment in the film. And then she's changing. Tanya is, and she turns around, and I can't remember the exact dialogue, like how she says it, but she's like, I know I spend most of my career half naked, but I don't normally do it in front of the help.
Nice. You got to be a homeowner. This is definitely the way to do it. Look, I'll get you some towels and sheets are clean. Don't sweat it. I don't plan on sleeping in this room anyway. Oh, wait a minute. You are just his nurse, aren't you? Yeah, I'm just his nurse. I mean, if you got something going with them, look, he's been sick. No problem. Just watch old Tanya perk him up. I'm going to take me a steam in Gary's bathroom and get the road dirt off. Oh, do you mind, sweetie? I mean, I know I make my living standing around half naked, but I don't like to do it in front of the help.
And you're like, okay, I give you a point because that's really, really, really bitchy, but also that's mean. Don't do that to Sheila. But it's such a great, and actually, you know, it's funny because it's kind of moving to me, maybe because I've been there all these years later, I've started to experience some of these things that maybe Sheila has gone through in terms of when she's at the house and he's playing the song for her and she's taking all the pills and you see Sheila laying in bed crying. Mm-hmm. And you know that feeling when you really like somebody and you just don't think they're interested. And it's just so well done.
And Sheila can probably hear that moment when the model gal reaches and rips Parker Stevenson's shirt open. She can, I bet she can hear the buttons pop.
Spread, I forgot about that.
And she's like, he's already singing that for him. And then all of a sudden, pop, 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 damn it. Oh, come on.
Yeah, it's kind of a heart-wrenching moment. She's such a great, I really like Sheila. She's I think Lisa Eilbacher is great in the lead. She's beautiful, but she's got a very girl next door persona, and she fits the role really well. Like you could see her as a nurse, and she fits in kind of the everyday role too very well. And it's interesting because she had a really amazing career in the 80s because, you know, she's in 10 to Midnight and she's also in Beverly Hills Cop.
She's the leading lady in Beverly Hills freaking Cop, the number one movie in 1984.
So I mean, she's a star, and so she has a lot of presence in this film, and but it's also really subtle. And so she just has like a likable, she's like the Sandra Bullock of This House Possessed. Like she just has a really likable quality that translates very well in the film. And so you're with her the whole way, you know what I mean? And her character is actually really interesting because there's layers to her trauma that gets slowly revealed, right? Like we hear it at the beginning where she has no memory of her childhood up to a certain age or whatever. And then when she is talking to Gary and he's asking her about her life, and you can tell she doesn't really know what she's saying. She's like, oh, my dad was a doctor, you know, sure. Mm-hmm. And then when she tells him what's happening, and it all kind of unfolds really nicely, that you kind of get a real sense of like tragedy with the character as well, you know. Plus she's got that great phone call at the beginning with whoever her boyfriend is, and it's that great line where she says, you can be married or divorced, but you can't be one of each in the relationship she's in, you know, indicating that he's married. And so like it also gives you this idea that she's been getting into like these kind of not great relationships, but ones that she knows are not going to go anywhere, you know. And so they kind of help her with this dealing with her life, you know, and not feeling like she belongs in the world or whatever. So it's actually a really well drawn out character too, you know. Like there's just a lot going on. Like I've seen this movie 1,000 times, so I know once you do that you start to like, I don't know if I'm projecting or whatever, but I kind of feel like there's a lot going on there that can be unearthed if you want to see it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think especially the if the house is planning everything from moment one, that's a heck of a long game and complicated game that a house is a house that can't get up and move is playing. I even after three times, I still find that the opening moment when the camera, so he chases those pesky kids away with the hole, or it chases the pesky kids away. I like that it's willing to kill when it has to, but if a couple of kids want to goof around on the lawn, maybe some other time it would have let them goof around. But today it's like, no, I got other stuff to do. Parker Stevenson's doing a show on ABC, and I got to watch that. I can't divide my time. So you got to get sprayed. Get out of here. I'm going to watch Parker on TV. And I just love that scene where the camera is slowly panning through the, I guess the computer room or whatever it is, where everything's covered and the monitors are there. And you just hear Parker Stevenson singing for like a minute. And the camera's just moving like, what's going on? Where is he, under one of these sheets? Where is he? What's going on? And then the camera goes up to the TV and you're like, okay. And you really do think at first, well, I mean, you're led to that. Oh, this house is really adores the light pop of Parker Stevenson. And the soft rock of Parker Stevenson. But you know in the end that it's got a much longer game that it's playing, and he's the main pawn, or I don't know that he he'd be using in the game. But I will say that that's the sequence where he's singing and it keeps cutting to all the ladies like going, oh. Now I know that they do that. I understand that they do that. But because this was the 80s, I kept thinking it was going to become like a male stripper scene because of the way he's like in the middle and he's got his shirt down almost his waist. And I thought there was going to be a point when the music started picking up and he started taking it off. And the ladies are going to be like, oh.
I think he talked about that in the interview, that he was like, in that kind of setup, he's like, they would have attacked me. You know, they're just all around in a circle, just like letting him do his thing. Yeah. It was kind of like the first version of Unplugged.
But they were being very respectful.
They were.
But I would have rushed the stage. I don't have control.
You would have been that one.
Yeah, I would have been the one that ruined everything, and they would have had to have security. And
would you have tried to stage dive?
Stage dive when there's no stage? That would have been really difficult. I will tell you, one time I went to go see Pearl Jam at the height of my love of Pearl Jam, and they came to Vegas. They did two nights in a row, and on the first night, I body surfed, which I've only done a couple times, but it's the best way to see the concert because I'm only 5'4", and so for me to see over people's heads, sometimes I have to get hoisted over them. And so I was body surfing, and they actually handed me over to the stage. I was actually on stage with Eddie Vedder for like 10 seconds before security pulled me off. Yeah, sure. It was amazing. And I just started screaming my head off, and then I was done.
All I could think of is the movie Top Secret, whenever Val Kilmer does a song and he like invites the girls up on stage and they're all screaming, so they just faint and they pass out.
Yeah, kind of. That's me. I'm very boy crazy. Yeah. You know, I have my course, guys. Yeah. And so I might have rushed the stage when Parker was singing. I'm not going to lie about that. But the one thing I want to say is, we were talking about how the house is waiting, and I thought, isn't it funny? Do you think that when, because it was for rent, right, before they bought it, do you think that people would rent it and they'd be like, God, this house is so beautiful, and whatever the version of the house's eyes were would just roll, and you're just like, yeah, whatever, you love me. I get it. I'm beautiful.
Yeah,
I'm waiting. Yeah, I'm taken. And I'm just waiting for her to come back. And you know what I mean? Do you think it's this ho-hum, like, sitting there for, like, decades or a decade or so?
Like, I am a house. You know, I have to make a living. You know, and so people have to live in here. But eventually the right people will show up.
Yeah, but I think the house was just waiting.
Yeah.
It was like, eventually I'm going to, you know, I'll have my Margaret.
Yes.
I'll figure it out.
Like any good ghost, yeah.
Do you think it's like, while it's waiting, it's playing its version of Gin Rummy?
Like maybe solitaire, maybe.
You solitaire. That's it. Like on the monitors, there's like a solitaire game.
I like Candy Crush. I like the thought that it might be like if there's a couple in there, maybe with a couple of like annoying kids or someone the house really doesn't like. You know, he'll constantly like keep ordering them like 20 pizzas or something like that. You know, you said, who keeps doing this? Come on. The calls came from inside the house. Oh. I don't know what to tell you.
Now, what if Bad Ronald moved into the house? What
You know
do you
what?
think?
I was thinking that earlier because Elisa Eilbacher, I was thinking
Oh, that's right.
like what if it was something like he's waiting for her, like, or is it Babs? I forget the name of the character in Bad
Oh,
Ronald.
Babs is the blonde, right? The youngest
Babs is,
daughter.
yeah, the one that he yeah that you know because I actually thought of that a few minutes ago. I thought, wouldn't it be funny if it was like Ronald somehow is controlling the house and he's just waiting for the right person to show up, and it could be someone from the first house he lived in.
Oh, so many movies we could pull out of this.
Yeah.
It never ends. So I think we've talked about most. I mean, I don't know if we want to add anything or.
I just want to add one thing. Do you think that after the blood shower, Tanya's attitude changed?
Oh, it changed. I wanted to see her leaving the house. Like, I'm sad that we didn't get to
yeah,
see that.
Yeah, we just didn't get to see it. It's like suddenly, like, she's collapsing
gone.
In the shower, and then the next, it's like they're talking about her.
Mm-hmm. I wondered, like, was she covered in blood when they found her, or was it an illusion? Because they don't really, I mm-hmm. mean, I guess they would have seen her covered in blood. I don't know how she would have gotten it off her, but there's no indication that that's what they saw, because they would have been really horrified.
I would wonder. I think maybe it was something like, maybe it wasn't blood, because where would the house get the blood? Maybe from an animal or something. Maybe it was something like this. It just, because when you see the blood is spraying all over her, and it takes her a while to figure out that it's blood, but blood is like sticky and doesn't feel like water at all.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if it's something like, maybe it was like a fake blood. And it just, there was, it freaked her out. And then at the moment where she's collapsed, maybe it went back to being like water again or something.
Yeah,
a lot of
I
it
wondered
washed
that.
Away. And maybe she just came out. It's raining blood. It's raining blood. Okay, dear. Do you have your pills? Let me take them.
You know,
okay,
but on the bright side, it, at least it means that her hair would have been okay.
Yes.
If it turned out it was an illusion or, you know, it was just water. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in Slumber Party Massacre Part 2, Courtney's taking a blood bath.
Oh, that's right.
And then when they go upstairs, it's just water.
Yes.
There's no blood.
I'm sure that This House Possessed was a direct inspiration.
I'm wondering.
Well, to be fair, it is about a rock singer, right? Like,
yes.
He's like the core of sexuality, right? For the protagonist.
And somebody with the last name Eilbacher is in Slumber Party Massacre 2.
Is there an Eilbacher in it? Is it Cindy? Yeah. Oh, Cindy is in it, right?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's right.
So yeah, another connection.
Wow.
We are on to something. We have broken something.
Something's happening.
Yes. Well, before I go into my very brief background, but I'm still thinking about Parker Stevenson, my beefy background.
Sure.
Do we all want to talk? I guess we've kind of sort of said it, but do we all want to say what our favorite murder or like brutal set piece? Because they might not have died in the scene, but like the most brutal set piece in the film for you. And I'll start, and Dan and I might agree on this. But I think after everything I say about the blood shower, I think it's the librarian dying in the car that really gets to the core of my being. I think it's terrifying. Although I love all of the death scenes and all of the like, what do you want to call those, like violent scenes? But that's mm-hmm. the one that really gets to me. Dan?
I would say this. I mean, I love a good blood shower, and the hose attack is fun. But I think, like I said, I think it's just the moment the car catches on fire and she can't get out of the car, suddenly it becomes brutal to me. I mean, like Slim Pickens getting the glass in his chest, that's, like we said, more graphic than I imagined you would see. But there's just something about her being trapped in there when they're like standing outside, like, we can't help you, and she's burning to death, which is just kind of horrible to me.
Yeah, it is. I was funny. I was joking with Parker Stevenson in the interview because his character kind of runs up to the car and he's like, I can't do anything about it. And he just like backs up. And it makes me think of that scene in Night of the Demon, the one with the Bigfoot, where
the Bigfoot.
Where, you know, where there's that, they're having that like human sacrifice And so the people yell something and they start this big forest fire. And, you know, because they scare off the people and they end up dropping like their torches or whatever. And then the campers are like, well, we can't do anything about it. And they walk away and I'm like, you just started a giant campfire, like a giant wildfire. Yeah. You know, and it always cracks me up. But when you were talking about the garden,
they're not the best group.
No, they're not the brightest group I've ever seen camping. But when you talked about the water hose, it's interesting and it never occurred to me, but the movie is bookended by that water hose, because at the end it actually grabs Parker Stevenson and it pulls him to the ground. And so the movie's actually bookended by it. And that's kind of funny. I never noticed that before. Nate, what's your favorite, like, violent, brutal scene in the film?
I mean, I agree with the two of you. It's, to me, it's just the idea. I mean, for one, the idea of burning to death is just horrible. But it's also, like, I would imagine, like, how it would feel to watch that happen to somebody but be powerless to do anything about it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think all around that would just be the worst.
It did love cooking people because it threw the woman, too, in the...
In the pool. I will say, you know, I don't know if you guys grew up with pools, but for a few years, I lived in a house with a pool, and we had a heater in the pool, and I will tell you, it did not go up to 220 degrees.
Yeah, but that's just your pool. That's not everybody's
true,
pool.
True. That's not the majesty of the house possessed. It was because I know that, like, my brother would have done something stupid and been like, oh, it's still too cold. Put it up to 190. You know, and you heard his friend screaming and boiling like lobster, like a half an hour later.
Do you remember those urban legends about old couples falling asleep in hot tubs and cooking themselves?
Oh, no, I don't.
That was an urban legend. Yeah, it's ridiculous. I think it's in one of those urban legend books, but I'd actually heard somebody tell me about that because I grew up in Vegas, so almost all the houses had a pool of some kind. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have like a traditional pool. We had the above ground pool, like the Doughboy pool, but we had friends with the built-in, the more fancy pools. And a lot of people had hot tubs because of it. And so I think that was a pretty prevalent urban legend because we knew somebody with a hot tub. And so, and they would get warm, not that warm, but, and so I think as a kid, it was easier to buy it because we had some kind of frame of reference for them. But like for years, I thought people cooked themselves in their hot tubs and it like really freaked me out. Like just thinking about it now, because they would say the way the urban legend worked in my mind, even though it doesn't seem plausible as an adult, is that it would cook you inside and then from the outside. But that doesn't make sense. Yes. It would have to go from the outside in. But I always just assumed it cooked like your liver and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have like a cooked liver and so you wouldn't be able to survive even if you woke up. Like that's just how I envision it. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. That's another Amanda confesses. But anyway, let's go through the brief bit of background I have. And then if we have any final thoughts, we will wrap them up there. So this movie originally aired on February 6, 1981 on ABC. It was directed by William Wyer and written by David Levinson. And we've talked about them a little because of this, but they also worked together in two other TV movies. And that is Fantasies and a movie called Kicks they did in 1985 with Shelley Hack and Anthony Geary. Fantasies was starred Suzanne Pleshette. It's another one of my all-time favorite TV movies. That one was a huge hit for the duo, but I will tell you This House Possessed didn't do so well in the ratings, and I'll get there in a second. The music is by Billy Goldenberg, and it's really good. It's really good, eerie, set piecing music. The lyrics, though, to the music that Parker Stevenson sings was composed by Carol Connors, who wrote a song, and I can't even think of the name of it now. I'm Gonna Fly is at it from Rocky. She's a Oscar-winning...
Gonna Fly Now? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm Gonna Fly Now. Oscar-winning songwriter. And I think she was discovered by Phil Spector. And I think she had an affair with Elvis Presley. I think she had like a pretty wild life. Yeah, I think she had a pretty wild life. And she's really interesting. And I remember Billy Goldenberg telling me that she was a really fascinating character. And I think Parker Stevenson mentioned her briefly in the interview. So This House Possessed ran against on CBS Dukes of Hazzard in Dallas, which was the juggernaut of Friday night. Yeah. So here's the interesting thing about NBC. So for years, This House Possessed was thought to have run against the Brady Girls Get Married. It was supposed to be a TV movie and it was scheduled to run on the same night. But for some reason, the week it ended up airing against This House Possessed, they decided to break it into 4 half-hour episodes of a TV show. And then they scrambled to fill in the time slot. So they ended up showing something on NBC called Quibi, which I've never heard of. The Baxters, another thing I never heard of, and something called Friday News Magazine. And so at 8:30, the Brady Girls ran, and then they had three or four episodes that were what the TV movie was supposed to be. And then they went into the Brady Brides, you know, the sitcom that came in that year, which I have every episode of that as well. I really love them.
of course.
Yeah, The Brady Girls Get Married is great, but it's available as a TV movie, and in reruns, it ran as a TV movie, but it didn't actually originally air as a TV movie, but it was made as a TV movie, if that makes sense. The Dukes and Dallas were, of course, number one and number two for the week. This House Possessed came in at number 44 out of 64 programs, so that's a pretty low rating. It tied with Those Amazing Animals for the week, which was a show I loved. And although it didn't do super high in the ratings, it did pull in ABC's largest audience that season for the Friday night movie with a 25 share. Yeah, so it did okay. It came in at number 115 for the season, tying with a rerun of 1979's Death Car on the Freeway, which we've talked about at length on here. I could only find one review of This House Possessed, which was by Cecil Smith of the LA Times. He said, quote, "The film ranges from being so ridiculous that it's funny to finally becoming downright chilling." He also said it was a very moral house. Like, so with the teenagers having sex, it was like moralistically, you know, whatever it was doing to them. And so it was kind of an interesting review. Yeah, to a degree.
Get off my land. That's
yeah, yeah. Get out of it. Yeah. And so the only other thing I could find about This House Possessed I thought was kind of funny. So when it originally ran, the LA Times got a piece of mail about the film. They were very unhappy with it airing. This was Kit Davis from Oceanside, California. Kit writes, "My family and I were extremely offended by commercials for the movie This House Possessed. We monitor our children's programs to keep them from unnecessary shock and horror, but we are powerless against commercials. If the networks feel they need to titillate the viewers with a glimpse of blood and horror, please suitably warn us." Then in August of 1982, Karen Baker from Simi Valley wrote, "Thanks to ABC for airing This House Possessed and Midnight Offerings. They were great movies." So, and that was for the rerun that happened in August of This House Possessed. But those are two of my favorite TV movies. So in August of 1982, I must have been flying high because I'm sure I watched both of those airings. But I think that's funny. He didn't even watch the movie. He was just pissed off about it.
And this was 1981. I mean, I remember I was too young and too scared to go see all the slasher movies coming out, but I was consistently scared by all the commercials they used to show for them.
That's right. That's right.
Oh my gosh. I mean, get dragged into grates or like Humongous or just all these things in my head. Yeah. Friday the 13th and all, you know, it's crazy.
I still get kind of freaked out, like, because, for instance, I don't remember TV spots for Mad Men when it originally aired, but you can watch them on the DVD that Anchor Bay put out. I don't know if it ported over to the latest release that I know The Stare Continues did the commentary for, but those TV spots are amazing. Mm-hmm. And they're freaky and they're very effective and they get to the heart of the film. You know what I mean? I don't know that I've ever seen a promo for This House Possessed. I mean, since its original airing, I'm positive I must have seen promos because I was so excited about the movie before it aired. But I don't know that I've seen a promo spot since then. I'd be curious to see how the film was advertised. I'm guessing they made great use of the blood shower in the car and the... I'm guessing. Yeah. I don't know, though. But anyway, that's really all the background I have on this movie. It really has very little in way of production history. So I was really happy that Parker Stevenson was happy to fill in some of the gaps and talk a little bit about the actors that he worked with and stuff. And so, again, this is a wonderful film. I think it's looking good at 40. It's got a rewatchability to it that so few films for me. I watch a lot of stuff over and over again. But, like, this is a movie that, like, it doesn't matter how many times I see it. I just sit down. And I just know I'm going to, for an hour and a half, my mind is just going to be in a place of peace where I can just let the movie unfold in front of me. You know what I mean? And, and at the same time, the older I get, the more kind of things I see in it. And so I don't think it's a completely superficial film. I don't know that they intended a lot of what I read into it, but it's there. And it's very worthwhile. And on top of that, one of the things I remember saying to Parker Stevenson was, I think it's such a shame that this movie did not get a legit home video release because it is really beautifully shot. And I don't know that there's been a pristine copy of it ever available. that I've been able to find, and watching on YouTube or getting a bootleg of it kind of diminishes how much care they put into the film. I think clearly that it's really well made and they took their time with it. And I think it did have like a longer shoot than most TV movies. I think Parker Stevenson said it shot for like 5 weeks, which is unheard of, right, in the world of TV movies. So I think they spent a lot of time trying to make a really decent film, and they did beyond that for me. So that's just my closing thoughts on that. Do you guys want to add anything, Dan?
I think it's a, I really enjoy it. I think it is rewatchable, which is fun. I think one thing to do, the more, maybe the third or fourth time you watch it, pay attention to those moments like the solar panel moment or some of the moments where the camera, like I'm just watching I have the funeral playing here after Slim Pickens' character dies. And there's a moment where it follows the two of them, Lisa and Parker there, as they're walking and they have their hands around each other in elaborate fashion. And they pass by a hearse and the camera kind of like pans along, sees them. And then it kind of like the hearse fills up the screen. And then it just sits there for a few seconds, and you think, what's going on? And then it cuts to another shot of them walking. You're like, what is the house in the hearse? What's going on? What's that? And there's all these. It's one of those fun movies where if you pay attention to all the little bits that you maybe wouldn't normally pay attention to, like in a TV movie or maybe in a movie in general, there are a lot of little nice little bits, and they I think it's well put together. It's well structured. I can see as I'm watching it, I can see how I can see how it's a comfort film to you. Because I could see how this could be I mean, like to me, like TV movies like Escape is a film I could put on at any time, and for 70 minutes I'm in a special place, and I could see exactly how this could be that sort of movie for someone and for you specifically. So yeah, I think maybe if you're listening and you haven't watched it, maybe it's your next comfort film. Maybe it's your 2021 comfort film. You'll watch it 30 or 40 times over the next year. Why not give it a try? It's fun. It's got Parker Stevenson and Lisa Eilbacher and a lot of other great people
too. Yeah. We didn't even mention Barry Corbin from Northern Exposures that got in one scene. He just shows up and then he's just a jerk. Yeah. He's the jerk cop. Yes. Are you guys smoking pot, you know? No, I'm not. And he just looks like he can't be bothered by this couple. And it's just such an amazing, weird moment in the film. It's just like a 2-minute scene. And you're like, isn't that Barry Corbin? Why isn't he starring in this? It also has David Paymer. Is it David Paymer or his brother?
Yes.
I think it's David. Yeah. And he goes, hey, don't get so frosted. Which is my favorite line.
You the guy with Strayhorn?
Yeah, Doc. King. Arthur King. How's Garrett?
Let me ask you a couple of questions. You know him pretty good?
The boy's like a son to me. Known him ever since he's been in the business.
Right. He must be his manager.
Yeah.
What's he into? Coke? Heroin? Pills?
Nothing. The boy don't use anything. Shoot, everybody in the business knows that.
Hey, look, man. I'm a doctor, not a cop. So spend me the magazine interview.
Hey, listen, Doc. I don't give a darn if you're J. Edgar Hoover or Albert Schweitzer, the kid's straight.
Okay. Don't get frosted. Just something I have to know. All right, what your friend apparently has is a case of total physical exhaustion, maybe with some mental fatigue thrown in. When's the last vacation he had?
It's been a long time. I told the boy he's been working too hard.
Yeah, well, he's going to get one now, whether he likes it or not. We're going to keep him here a few days till he's out of the woods, run a few tests. I'll keep you posted. Hey, what makes a guy work like that?
Same as you. Dedication.
Not me, man. I'm in it for the money.
There is an interesting moment where that character plays a doctor talking to Slim Pickens about Parker Stevens' character being exhausted in the hospital. And the doctor character is walking away, he turns around and says, you know, what makes someone, you know, get so sort of determined on something that they, that this happens to them? And I forget exactly what Slim Pickens says, but like, you know, just like he's, you know, it's his thing. It's his life, you know, just like with you. And the doctor says, I'm in this for the money. And he keeps on walking.
Yeah, and that's it. And that's the scene.
Yes,
it's great. It's full of all these really wonderful faces, and it's just a great film. And Nate, do you have any closing thoughts?
I liked it.
You did. I'm so happy. I'm so happy that people enjoy this movie. And it does have a minor cult following. And it's really nice to see that after all these years, some people hold it in such a high regard. So I'm really happy to be doing this. And I hope everybody enjoyed listening to it. And I'm hoping to get a couple more actors throughout the year, if things work out, to talk about more TV movie work. So just stay tuned. We've got another episode coming up in a few weeks. And we're going to have a guest. I guess I can announce the guest. It's going to be Joseph Henson from The Hysteria Continues. He's the only one I haven't had from the show on here. And I'm kind of bummed that it took this long. But I can never remember the name of the second film that I picked. That's why I haven't announced it. But I will promote that. And if people want to send in feedback to that, they can. And that'll be just probably a few weeks after this comes out. So just stay tuned. Thank you for listening. And you know what? Sensitive, you're not, guys. Just deal with it.
Bye, Margaret.
Bye.
Bye.